6. Marcy stopped on the image of the monster. It was evening. People chatted softly around her in the dining car, and the train rolled around a picturesque bend, but for a moment she was transfixed by that image. A sketch of violent, rough lines that somehow conveyed a terrible dread. Most of the pages contained in the stack Vendel had delivered contained transcripts of questions answered, or more often not answered, by the wounded Chandra. This was different. A wild sketch using two colors of pencil to depict a terrible visage. A burning red face, a distorted mouth, horns and spikes streaking out along the rim. But black eyes, drawn like voids on the red skin. It looked like a childhood terror ripped right out of a nightmare. The bottom of the page had a caption. Rilleur's sketch of creature described on 87342. Yesterday. The next page was an interview. Vendel, describe to us again the thing you saw. Rilleur, the beast. Vendel, yes, the beast. It guarded the bracers? Rilleur, no, no! It was before. Fallen from the sky. Vendel, the sky? Rilleur, the darkness above. It is of the void. It has no eyes. It looks at me. It's looking at me now. Further questioning was delayed for an hour as Rilleur whimpered in the corner, inconsolable. When he became responsive again, he drew this sketch without prompting, muttering about the thing he had seen. Something is wrong with the eyes of the creature. Perhaps spikes? Spikes. Marcy pulled her purse from under the table, digging into it as the couple at the table behind her laughed loudly, calling for more wine. Marcy pushed aside the two-shot pistol she had tucked inside and took out a thin book, a copy of the one that Iron Eyes had given to Waxillium. Inside it she found the description she wanted, words written by the Lord Mistborn, Lestiborn. So far as I've been able to figure out, hemallergy can create practically anything by rewriting its spiritual aspect. But hell, even the Lord Ruler had trouble getting it right. His Kolos were great soldiers. I mean, they could eat dirt and stuff to stay alive. But they basically spent all day killing each other on a whim, and resented no longer being human. The Chandra are better, but they turn to piles of goop if they don't have spikes, and they can't reproduce on their own. I guess what I'm saying is that you shouldn't experiment too much with this aspect of hemallergy. It's basically useless. There are a million ways to mess up for every one way there is to get a good result. Stick to transferring powers and you'll be better off. Trust me. It was so odd to read the Lord Mistborn's words and have them sound so casual. This was the survivor of the flames, the governor who had ruled mankind in benevolence for a century, guiding them on the difficult path to rebuild civilization. He sounded so normal. He even admitted in one section to having Breeze, counselor of the gods, write most of his speeches for him. So all of the famous words, quotes, and inscriptions attributed to the Lord Mistborn were fabrications. Not that he was a fool. No, the book was full of insight. Disturbing insight. The Lord Mistborn advocated gathering the Metalborn who were elderly or terminally ill, then asking them to sacrifice themselves to make these spikes, which could in turn be used to create individuals of great power. He made a good argument in the book. It wouldn't have been so disturbing if it had been easy to dismiss. She studied the descriptions of hemallergic experiments in the book, trying to ignore the loud couple behind her. Could this drawing be of a new kind of hemallergic monster, like those Wax had encountered under Ellendel? Designed by the Set, or perhaps the result of a failed experiment? Or was this instead related to the continually ephemeral Trell, the god with an unknown metal? She eventually put them aside and focused on her primary task. How to find Rilleur's spike. He'd been wounded in some kind of explosion that had ripped off part of his body, and he'd been forced to flee, leaving the flesh and the spike behind. Chandra flesh remained in its human-like state once cut free of the body, so those cleaning up after the explosion would have simply disposed of it, right? She needed to see if they'd created some kind of mass grave for people killed in that explosion. Of course, if the set knew what to look for in a Chondra's corpse, they might have recovered the spike. The pictures, and the possibility they were experimenting with hemallergy, made that more plausible. So that was another potential lead. And was that Wayne's voice? Marcy turned to look at the laughing couple behind her. Sure enough, Wayne had joined them and was chatting amicably with the drunk pair who wore fine evening attire. Wayne, as usual, was in his rough trousers and suspenders. Duster hung on the peg beside the table. He saw Marcy and grinned, drinking a cup of the couple's wine before bidding them farewell. The train hit a sharp bump, causing plates to rattle on tables as Wax slid into the seat across from Marcy, his face full of grin. "Mooching wine?" Marcy asked.
"Nah," he said. "They're drinking bubbly. Can barely stand the stuff. I'm mooching accents. Those folks, they're from New Sarin. Gotta get a feel for how people talk there."
"Ah, you do realize it's proper to remove your hat indoors, correct?"
"Sure do."
He tipped his hat at her, then leaned back in his chair and somehow got his booted feet up on the small table.
"What are you doing in here?" he asked.
"The dining car?" Marcy asked. "I just wanted a place to spread out."
"Wax rented us out an entire train car, woman," Wayne said, pointing at a passing waiter, then pointing at his mouth and making a tipping motion. "We've got like 6 rooms or something, all to ourselves."
"Maybe I simply wanted to be around people."
"And we ain't people?"
"That is subject to some dispute in your case."
He grinned, then winked at her as the waiter finally stepped over.
"You wanted," the waiter began. "Liquor," Wayne said.
"Would you care to be a little more specific, sir?"
"Lots of liquor."
The waiter sighed, then glanced at Marcy, and she shook her head.
"Nothing for me."
He moved off to obey.
"No bubbly,"
Wayne shouted after him, earning him more than one glare from the car's other occupants. He then turned to eye Marcy.
"So? Gonna answer my question? What are you hiding from, Marcy?"
She sat for a moment, feeling the rhythmic rattle of the train's motion.
"Does it ever bother you to be in his shadow, Wayne?"
"Who? Wax? I mean, he's been putting on weight, but he's not that fat yet, is he?"
He grinned, though that faded when she didn't smile back. And, in an uncharacteristic moment of solemnity, he slid his boots off the table and rested one elbow on it instead, leaning toward her.
"Nah," he said after some thought. "Nah, it doesn't. But I don't care much if people look at me or not. Sometimes my life is easier if they ain't looking at me, you know? I like listening."
He eyed her.
"You saw that he thought you couldn't do this on your own?"
"No," she said. "But I don't know, Wayne. I studied law in the first place, studied famous law keepers, because I wanted to become something others thought I couldn't. I got the job at the precinct and thought I'd accomplished something. But Aradel later admitted he was first interested in hiring me because he wanted someone who could get close to and keep an eye on Waxillium. We both know that Chondra wanted him on this mission, and they arranged the meeting with me to try to hook him. At the precinct, when I accomplish something, everyone assumes I had Waxillium's help. Sometimes it's like I'm no more than an appendage."
"You're not that at all, Marcy," Wayne said. "You're important. You help out a lot. Plus you smell nice, and not all bloody and stuff."
"Great. I have no idea what you just said."
"Appendages don't smell nice," Wayne said, "and they're kind of gross. I caught one out of a fella once."
"You mean an appendix?"
"Sure."
He hesitated.
"Not the same thing."
"Right. Thought you was making a metaphor, since people don't need one of those and all."
Marcy sighed, leaning back and rubbing her eyes with the heels of her hands. Why was she discussing this with Wayne again?
"I understand," he said. "I know what you're feeling, Mara. Wax, he's kind of overwhelming, eh?"
"It's hard to fault him," Marcy said. "He's effective, and I don't think he even knows that he's being overbearing. He fixes things. Why should I be upset about that?
Rust Swain, I studied his life, admiring what he did. I should feel lucky to be part of it. And I do, mostly.
Wayne nodded. But you want to be your own person.
Exactly.
Nobody's forcing you to stay with us, Wayne noted. As I recall, Wax spent a lot of effort at first trying to keep you from always getting involved.
I know. Well, this once I was thinking for a time that I might be able to do something important on my own.
She took a deep breath, then let it out.
It's stupid, I know, but it still feels frustrating. We'll do all this work, find that spike, and get back to the Chondra, then they'll thank Waxillium.
Wayne nodded thoughtfully. I knew this fellow once, he said, leaning back again, his feet on the table. Who thought it would be a good idea to take people hunting? City folk, you know, who ain't never seen an animal larger than a rat who ate too much. Out in the roughs, we got lions. Fierce things with lots of teeth and...
I know what a lion is, Wayne.
Right. Well, Chip, that's his name. He got some broadsheets printed up, but borrowed some notes from his girl in order to do it. And so she thought she should get a piece of the money once he got people to pay for this trip. Well, the first money came in, and they got in a fight, and she ended up stabbing him right in the holster, if you know what I mean. So he stumbles out into the street, all bleeding, and that's where the constables found him and told him you can't be killing no lions. There's a law about it, see? As they're some kind of noble natural treasure or some such. Anyway, they took Chip and stuffed him in jail where they slammed the bars, by accident, on his rusted fingers. Broke his hand up right good, and he can't bend the tips of his fingers no more.
His drink arrived, a bottle of whiskey and a small cup. He took it, telling the waiter to charge Waxillium, then poured some and settled back.
Is that the end? Morrissey asked.
What? Wayne said. You want more to happen to the poor fellow? Right sadistic of you, Morrissey. Right sadistic.
I didn't mean... She took a breath. Did that have any relevance to the situation I'm in?
Not really, Wayne said, taking a drink, then removing a little wooden box from his pocket and getting out a ball of gum. But I tell you, Chip, he has it really bad. Whenever I'm thinking my life is miserable, I remember him and tell myself, well, Wayne, at least you ain't a broke, dickless fella what can't even pick his own nose properly, and I feels better.
He winked at her, popped the gum in his mouth, then slipped away from the table. He waved to Milan, who was wearing a fine lace gown and oversized hat. A normal woman would have needed quite the corset to pull off the outfit, but the Chondra had probably just sculpted her body to fit, which was horribly unfair. Morrissey stared at the notes. Wayne had left her feeling confused, which was not unusual, but perhaps there was wisdom in what he said. She dug back into the research, but it wasn't too long before she started to droop. It was getting late, the sun having fully set outside, and they wouldn't arrive for another few hours, so she packed up the stack of pages inside their large folder. As she did, something slipped out of the folder. Morrissey frowned, holding it up. A small cloth pouch. Opening it revealed a small Pathian earring and a note. Just in case, Waxillium. She yawned, tucking it away, and pushed out of the dining car. The private car Waxillium had hired for them was two cars back at the tail end of the train. She held tight to the sheets as she stepped onto the open-air platform between cars, wind whipping at her. A short railman stood there and eyed her as she crossed to the next car. He didn't say anything this time, though last time he'd tried to encourage her not to move between cars, insisting that he'd bring her food if she wished. The next car over was first class with a row of private rooms on one side. Morrissey passed electric lights glowing on the walls as she crossed the car. Last time she'd been on a train, those had been gas with bright, steady mantles. She liked progress, but these seemed much less reliable. They'd waver when the train slowed, for example. She crossed to the final car, then passed her own room and walked toward the room where Waxillium and Steris had taken dinner, to check on them. Both were still there, surprisingly. Waxillium she had expected, but late nights were not Steris's thing. Maracy slid open the door, peeking in. Vexillium? The man knelt on the floor, his seat covered in ledgers and sheets of paper. Eyes intent on one of them, he held up his hand toward her in a quieting gesture as she started to ask what he was doing. Maracy frowned. Why?
Aha! Vexillium proclaimed, standing up. I found it.
What? Steris said. Where?
Tips.
I looked in Tips.
One of the dock workers turned the request in late,
Vexillium said, grabbing a sheet and spinning it toward Steris. He tipped a dock boy 4 clips to run a message for him and asked for reimbursement. Dockmaster gave it to him and filed a note, but he wrote the 4 like a 3 and the accountants recorded it that way.
Steris looked it over with wide eyes.
You bastard,
she said, causing Maracy to blink. She'd never heard language like that from Steris.
How did you figure this out?
Vexillium grinned, folding his arms.
Wayne would say it's because I'm brilliant.
Wayne has the mental capacity of a fruit fly, Steris said. In comparison to him, anyone is brilliant.
She trailed off, noticing Maracy for the first time. She blinked, and her expression became more reserved.
Maracy, welcome. Would you like to sit?
On what? Maracy asked. Every surface was covered in ledgers and pages.
The luggage rack? Are those house finances?
I found a lost clip, Vexillium said. The last one, I should add, which gives me 2 for the evening, while Steris found 1.
Maracy stared at Steris, who started clearing a place for her to sit. She looked to Vexillium, who stood beaming with the sheet in his hand, looking it over again as if it were some lost medal he'd rescued from a labyrinth.
A lost clip, Maracy said. Great. Maybe you can find something in these.
She held up the pages Vendel had given her. I'm heading to bed for a few hours.
Hmm?
Vexillium said.
Oh, sure. Thanks.
He set down the page with some reluctance, taking the folder.
Be sure to look at the drawings of monsters,
Maracy said, yawning.
Oh, and this was in there.
She tossed him the pouch with the earring and walked back into the hallway. She walked toward her room, feeling the train slow once more. Another town? Or were there sheep crossing the tracks again? They were supposed to be getting into the part of the route that was the prettiest. Too bad it would be so dark out. She walked back to her door, first of those in their car, and glanced out the front window toward the rest of the train, which she was surprised to see moving off into the distance. She gaped for a moment, and then the door at the other end of the car burst open. The man standing on the platform beyond leveled a gun down the corridor and fired. 7.
Well, I think you showed a real talent for this, Lord Vexillium, as I believe I suggested.
Wax stopped listening to Steris. Train slowing, chugging sounds retreating, door opening. Wax burned steel. Steris continued talking, and he nodded absently, part of him going through the motions as the rest of him came alert. He heard a click and pushed to his left and held it, pushing to the right against the frame of the train car to keep himself from moving. As the bullet passed in the hallway outside, his push, already in place, slammed it sideways into the wall.
Go!
His push had shoved open the door. He dropped the earring, damn that Vendel, and pushed to the right on the train car's metal window frame. This launched him out to the left, streaking into the hallway. He rammed into the wall where he'd pushed the bullet, vindication in hand, and drilled the surprised man at the end of the hallway in the forehead. Maracy clipped off a scream. Steris stuck her head out into the hallway wide-eyed. Not the smartest move, but she'd rarely been in gunfights.
Thanks,
Maracy said. He nodded curtly. Get your sister behind some cover. He slipped past her and stepped out onto the small platform between train cars. Only their car had been unhooked and left to drift. A group of 3 shocked-looking men on horses rode alongside the slowing car.
Horses? Wax thought. Really?
By the starlight, which was bright tonight with no clouds and the red rip low on the horizon, he could see they wore vests over their shirts and sturdy trousers. A larger crowd of them galloped alongside the train ahead. This wasn't a specific attack on just his car, but a full-blown armed robbery. That meant he had to be quick. He shoved on the platform beneath him and decreased his weight. The three robbers nearby started firing, but Wax's push flung him into the air above their shots, and his decreased weight meant that the wind resistance pushed him backward onto the train car. He landed, increased his weight, and picked one man off his horse. The remaining bandits took off forward, kicking their horses and chasing after the others, yelling,
"Allomancer! Allomancer!"
Blast, Wax thought, dropping one of them as the other dodged his horse into a stand of trees. He was out of pistol range in a moment and would soon catch his fellows. Wax dropped onto the platform and rushed down the hallway. The room he'd shared with Steris was empty, but he spotted quivering blue lines in the one next door. Maracy had wisely piled everyone into the servants' compartment.
"Robbery,"
Wax said as he threw open the door, startling the servants, Maracy, and Steris. Most of them sat on the floor, though Maracy was by the window peeking out, and Steris was on the built-in seat, remarkably composed.
"Robbers?"
Steris asked.
"Really, Lord Waxillium, must you bring your hobbies with you everywhere we go?"
"They're going after the rest of the train," Wax said, pointing. "The first thieves must have recognized this car as a private one, probably lush with riches to plunder, and so they uncoupled it. But something is wrong."
"Other than people trying to kill us?" Maracy asked. "No," Steris said. "In my experience, that's quite normal."
"What's wrong," Wax said, "is that they're riding horses."
The others stared at him. "Horseback train robberies," Wax said, "are something out of the story magazines. Nobody actually does that. What good does it do to board a moving train, risking your life when you can just stop the vehicle like the Vanishers did?"
"So our bad guys," Maracy said.
"New to this," Wax said, "or they've been reading too much cheap fiction. Either way, they're still going to be dangerous. I can't risk leaving you here in case they come back for you, so keep your heads down and hang on."
"Hang on?" Herb said. "Why?"
Wax ducked back out into the hallway and ran to the back end of the car. After checking out the doorway, he jumped onto the tracks behind the private car, which was finally rolling to a stop. Then he tapped his metal mines and increased his weight. A lot. The gravel sank beneath his feet as his body became increasingly heavy. He gritted his teeth, flared his metal, and pushed. The car lurched in place as if another train had crashed into it. His push sent it rattling along the tracks, and Wax let out his breath. His muscles didn't hurt, but he felt as if he'd slammed into a wall. He released his metal mind, returning his weight to normal, and pushed on the rails to pull himself out of the gravel. He almost lost a boot in the process. He pushed once more against the tracks, sending himself chasing after the moving car. "Not nearly fast enough," he thought as he dropped to the ground and increased his weight again. The car rocked as he shoved it, then he hopped and followed, repeating the process three more times to get it up to speed. Then finally he pushed himself all the way up to it, jamming his shoulder against the back wall and using allomancy on the tracks behind to sustain and increase the momentum. Ground passed behind in a blur, rows and rows of wooden ties, the steel rails with a continuous stream of metal lines that pointed toward Wax's chest. He groaned and moved so his back was against the wall. Still, the pushing threatened to crush him, as he couldn't increase his weight here much or risk ripping up the tracks. They shot past a group of horses with a few youths guarding them, the bandits' extra mounts. Wax raised Vindication and fired a few shots into the air, but the horses were too well trained to spook at the sound. He redoubled his push as he thought he heard gunfire ahead of him. A moment later, his car slammed into the train proper. Wax let go, dropping to the platform, his back aching. The couplers had engaged, however, and the car remained attached to the rest of the train. He peeked into the car, then ducked in, passing the room where the others were hiding. In his own compartment, he dropped Vindication into her holster, then yanked his gun case off the top rack.
"Waxillium,"
Maracy said, slipping into the room.
"You seen Wayne?" Wax asked.
"He was in the dining car a little bit ago."
"He'll be fighting already. If you see him, let him know I'm going to hit the front of the train, then sweep backward."
Wax snapped one Sterion closed, now loaded, then reached for the second.
"Got it,"
Maracy said. She hesitated.
"You're worried?"
"No masks."
"No."
"Robbers wear masks," Wax said.
He clicked the second Sterion closed, then buckled on his gun belt. Vindication, after a reload, went back into his shoulder holster.
"And men who don't wear masks?"
"They don't care if they're seen."
He looked over and met her eyes. They're already outlaws and don't have anything to lose. Men like that kill easily. What's more, it's obvious to me that they've never tried a train robbery before. Either they are very, very desperate, or someone put them up to this. She paled.
You don't think the attack is a coincidence?
If it is, I'll eat Wayne's hat. He eyed the shotgun Renette had given him, then tied on his thigh holster and slipped it in. Then hung two of her cord and sphere contraptions from his gun belt. Finally, he reached up and took a rifle bag off the top shelf and tossed it to Marcy. Watch Steris, he said. See if you can find Wayne. Check on the next car or two, but don't worry about advancing farther if you meet resistance. Just hold your ground and protect these people.
Right.
He moved toward the hallway, but as soon as he stepped out, a hail of gunfire drove him back again. He cursed. All it would take was one aluminum bullet, which he couldn't push on, and he'd be dead. He took a deep breath, then glanced out quickly while pushing and counted four bandits on the rear platform of the next car forward. They fired again. He ducked back and watched the blue lines of bullets as they flew, taking chunks of wood paneling off the wall and splintering his doorframe. It didn't appear that any of the bullets were aluminum.
Distraction? Marcy asked.
Yes, please, Wax said, increasing his weight and pushing on the window frame, launching it out the side of the car and against a passing tree. Fire a few times as I leave, then give me a count of 20, followed by a distraction.
Will do.
Wax threw himself out the window. Immediately he fired Vindication downward, burying a bullet in the ground and giving him something to push on to launch himself upward. Marcy fired a few quick shots inside, and hopefully the robbers would assume his shot had been inside as well. Soaring high, wind whipping at his hair and suit coat, he shot a second bullet into the ground, but farther out, and used it to nudge himself to the right, placing him above the train. He didn't let himself touch down, instead using a push on the nails on the train roof to keep him flying forward. He soared over his own car and the one the robbers were in, finally landing on the dining car, which was third from the back. As he turned to face the rear, his mental count hit 20. A second later, he heard a spray of gunfire coming from Marcy. That was his mark. Wax dropped between the dining car and the robber's car. He practically fell on top of one of the robbers, backing out of the second car from the end, which he hadn't expected. Wax leveled his gun, but the surprised man punched him in the gut. Wax grunted, increasing his weight. The platform beneath him strained, but when he shoved the robber with his shoulder, it sent the man tumbling toward the tracks. The robber had kindly left the door open for him, and he had a clean shot at the backs of his fellows at the far end who were focused on Marcy in the last train car beyond. Wax didn't shoot. He just pushed on the metal they were carrying. The men flipped off the rear platform, dropping into the space between cars. One caught the railing. Wax shot him in the arm, then turned, leveling his gun toward the dining car. People cringed inside, hiding under tables, whimpering. Rusts. Without bandanas or identifying marks to watch for, he'd have trouble spotting the bandits. He set up his steel bubble, a faint push away from himself in all directions that excluded his own weapons. It was far from perfect. He'd been shot several times while using it, but it did help. He turned and strode into the second car from the back, the one the robbers had been using, checking for hostiles at each door, his steel bubble rattling doorknobs. First-class passengers were hiding here, and none appeared to be hurt. In Wax's car, Marcy ducked out of the room, carrying one of Wax's favorite hats. She shrugged apologetically at its numerous holes. "If I find Wayne, I'll send him to you," he told her, reaching to his gun belt for a metal vial. He came up with wet fingers, and his belt clinked with broken glass. Damn. The robber who'd slugged him had broken his vials. He hurriedly hopped over the space between cars, entering their private car again. "I need metal," he explained at Marcy's inquisitive look. He stepped up to his room, then hesitated as a hand stuck out of the next room down, holding a small vial. "Steris?" he said, walking to her. She was still sitting on the plush train bench, though her face was paler than before.
"Steel flakes in suspension," she said, wiggling the vial.
"Since when have you carried one of these?" Wax asked, taking it from her.
"Since 6 months ago. I put one into my purse, in case you might need it."
She raised her other hand, displaying two more.
"I carry the other two because I'm neurotic."
He grinned, taking all three. He downed the first one, then nearly choked.
"What the hell is in this?"
Other than steel? Steris asked. Cod liver oil?
He looked at her, gaping.
Whiskey is bad for you, Lord Waxillium. A wife must look out for her husband's health.
He sighed and drank one more, then tucked the last into his gun belt.
Stay safe. I'm going to scout the train.
He left and threw himself out the end door, pushing on the tracks and launching himself in a high arc upward. The land spread before him, bathed in starlight. The southern end of the basin, approaching the Saren mountain range, was far more varied in geography than the northern portion. Here, hills rolled across the land, which slowly increased in elevation. The Saren River cut a strikingly straight path through the hills, often having carved out gorges and canyons. The train line stayed up higher, hugging the tops of hillsides, though its path required it to cut two or three times across the river on large latticework bridges. The train consisted of 8 passenger cars, several cargo cars, and a dining car. He let himself drop, focusing on a specific car near the front where gunshots sounded. As he landed just behind that car, someone stumbled out onto the platform, holding his face. Armed bank guard, he thought, noting the man's uniform. The train was bringing a payroll shipment inside a courier car, disguised as if carrying a more mundane cargo. What was that scent in the air? Formaldehyde? The guard was gasping, and soon another stumbled out after him. Both fell a moment later to gunfire from inside the courier car. Wax dropped down onto the platform beside the fallen men, checking on them. One was still moving. Wax knelt and moved the man's hand to cover the hole in his shoulder.
"Press hard," he said over the sounds of the thumping track. "I'll be back for you."
The man nodded weakly. Wax took a deep breath and stepped into the courier car, where his eyes immediately started burning. Men moved inside, wearing strange masks and working at a large safe in the center. A half-dozen dead guards lay strewn across the floor of the car. Wax started shooting, flooring several of the robbers, then pushed himself out again, then upward as the others took cover and started firing back. He landed on the car behind the courier car, holstered Vindication, who was out of bullets, and brought out Asterion. He prepared to drop down to try picking off more robbers, but an explosion inside the courier car interrupted him. It was a small blast, as explosions went, but it still left Wax's ears ringing. He winced and dropped to the platform, noticing figures moving in the smoke, stooping beside the safe, removing its contents. Others started firing at him. He ducked to the side, then pushed the door to the courier car closed, locking the gunfire with a reinforced metal door. He grabbed the wounded guard under his arms and pulled him backward over the small gap between platforms and into the passenger car behind. This was another car with private compartments, though second class, where those rooms had been filled with larger groups. It was currently empty. The passengers, hearing the gunfire in the next car, had fled down the train. He checked each room anyway. Afterward, he propped the wounded man against the wall inside one of the rooms and tied a handkerchief around the wound, pulling it tight.
"Money,"
the guard said.
"They've got the money,"
Wax replied. "Stopping them isn't worth risking any more lives."
"But—"
"I got a good look at several of them," Wax said, "and hopefully so did you. We'll give descriptions, chase them down, set a trap on our terms. Besides, if they leave now, there might be time to help a few of your friends in there." The guard nodded weakly.
"Couldn't stop them. They threw bottles through the windows, and then the doors ripped off. Steel pushers. Pushed into the room. Twisted off their hinges like they were paper."
Wax felt a chill. So the bandits had metal born, too. Wax peeked around the wall back toward the courier car and found the door he'd closed open again. A thin man stood on the platform wearing a long coat and supporting himself on a cane. He gestured, speaking urgently and motioning for another bandit to lumber toward Wax's car, a hulking brute who had to be almost 7 feet tall.
"Wonderful. Get in here,"
Wax said to the guard, pulling open the luggage compartment in the room's floor.
"Keep your head down."
The guard crawled into the compartment, which was cramped and shallow but large enough for a person, even with a few pieces of luggage in it. Wax pulled out both Asterions, crouching in the doorway of the private room. The train continued to rock, going around a bend. The thing hadn't stopped. Did the engineer not know about the attack, or was he hoping to get to the next town?
Rusts. The courier car changed all of Wax's assessments. Maybe this wasn't about him.
But why not just stop the train and raid it in the wilderness? Too many questions and no time to answer them. He had a bandit to kill. He'd have to jump out and surprise the brute, bring him down quick. If he was the Metalborn, surprise would be... Something bounced down the hallway and came to a rest on the floor beside Wax, just outside the doorway in which he crouched. A small metal cube. He jumped back, fearing an explosive, but nothing happened. What had that been? And then he realized, with a deep, bone-chilling horror, that he was no longer burning metal. There was nothing inside of him to burn. His steel reserves had, somehow, vanished. Maracy fired 3 shots with a rifle, driving the bandits in the next car back under cover.
Impressive, she thought, absently handing the weapon to Steris for reloading.
She'd always used a target rifle before. You took one shot at a time with those, cocking between, but Waxillium's rifle had a full wheel of cartridges that turned on its own like a revolver. Steris handed back the gun and Maracy took aim again, waiting for any bandit bits to peek out. She hid just inside the door to the servants' compartment, and the bandits hadn't made any serious attempts at advancing on her position. Someone said something beside her. Maracy glanced into the room where Druten was speaking. Maracy pulled out one of her wax earplugs.
What?
She asked.
Are those earplugs?
The valet asked.
What do they look like?
She said, then sighted down the rifle and fired a shot. Druten shoved his hands over his ears. Indeed, in the small chamber the shot was loud enough that she was annoyed he'd made her remove her earplug.
You carry them with you? Druten asked.
Steris does.
Apparently. Maracy had been a little surprised when Steris had pulled out a pair for herself, then, an unconcerned look on her face, handed a pair to Maracy.
So you expected this to happen?
More or less, Maracy said, watching for movement from the bandits. He seemed aghast.
This sort of thing happens often?
Would you say it happens often, Steris? Maracy asked.
Hmm?
Steris said, removing an earplug.
What was that?
Maracy fired a shot, then looked up.
Think I winged that one.
The valet wants to know if this sort of thing happens often to us.
You more than me, Steris said conversationally. But when Lord Waxillium is around, things do tend to pop up.
Things? Druten said. Pop up? This is a rusting train robbery!
Steris regarded the valet with a cool expression.
Didn't you inquire about your prospective master before entering Lord Waxillium's employ?
Well, I mean, I knew he had an interest in the constabulary, like some lords have an interest in the symphony or in civic matters. It seemed odd, but not ungentlemanly. I mean, it's not as if he was involved in the theater.
They've gone quiet over there, Maracy thought, nervously tapping one finger against the rifle barrel. Were they going to try to cross over onto the top of her car again? One of the holes in the ceiling still dripped blood from the previous attempt. To the side, Steris clicked her tongue disapprovingly at Druten's words. He hadn't done his homework, which was a dreadful sin in Steris's eyes. Little could be worse than entering a situation without being thorough.
Is he going to come back? Druten asked.
Once he's finished, Steris said.
Finished with what?
Killing the rest of them, hopefully, she said.
Maracy found herself surprised at Steris's bloodthirst. Of course, the woman hadn't been quite the same since her kidnapping 18 months back. It wasn't that Steris acted traumatized, but she'd changed.
They aren't trying to get to us anymore, Druten said. Did they retreat?
Maybe, Maracy said.
Probably not.
Should we go look? Druten asked.
We?
Well, you.
He tugged at his collar.
Gunfights. I had not actually expected gunfights. Aren't the servants usually left out of such extravagances?
Most of the time, Maracy said.
Except when the house blew up, Steris added.
Except then.
And, you know, Steris said, best not to mention it.
Mention what?
Druten asked.
Don't worry about it, Maracy said, glaring at Steris.
Honestly, if the man couldn't do a little research before taking a job...
Wait,
Druten said, frowning.
What exactly happened to Lord Ladrian's
previous valet.
Motion in the hallway again. Maracy snapped her rifle up, ready to fire. However, the person who moved out into the hallway wasn't one of the bandits, but an older woman in a fine traveling dress. A bandit walked behind her, gun to her head. Maracy shot him right in the forehead. She gaped, shocked at herself, and almost dropped the gun. Fortunately, the remaining bandit, seeing that the ploy hadn't worked, ran out of the car, fleeing toward the front of the train.
Rusts.
Maracy felt sweat trickle down her temple. She'd fired so quickly without even thinking. The poor hostage stood there, blood from the dead man all over her. Maracy knew what that felt like. Yes, she did. Beside her, Druten let out a few oaths that would have made Harmony blush.
What were you thinking?
He demanded of her.
You could have hit the woman!
Statistics. Statistics say...
Maracy took a deep breath.
Shut up!
Huh? Shut up!
She stood, holding the gun in nervous hands, and made her way into the next car. The woman had found her husband, alive, fortunately, and was crying in his arms. Maracy stood over the bandit corpse, then looked back out at the roof of her car, where another one lay. She hated this part. A year and a half working with Waxillium hadn't made killing any easier. It was unnerving, and it was such a waste. If you had to shoot a man, society had already failed. Maracy steeled herself and did a quick check of the rooms of the first-class car, determining that the bandits had well and truly retreated. One of the first-class passengers claimed to have experience with a gun, and she handed him the rifle and set him watching to be certain no bandits returned. From there, she went to the dining car, checking on the passengers, calming them. Gunshots came from farther up the train. Waxillium was doing his job. His effective, brutal job. The next car up, fourth from the end, was a second-class car with packed rooms. She checked on the people here, too. Between the two cars, she found four people who had been shot. One was dead, another seriously wounded. So Maracy went to see if Steris had, by chance, brought any bandages or medical equipment. The chances were slim, but this was Steris. Who knew what she had planned for? Maracy passed Druten, who sat morosely on a seat in one of the first-class cabins, obviously wondering how an expert cravat tire had ended up in the middle of a virtual war zone. Steris, however, wasn't in the servants' compartment, nor was she in the one she had been sharing with Waxillium. Increasingly frantic, Maracy searched through the first-class rooms. No Steris. Finally, she thought to ask the man she'd posted on guard.
Her?
He said.
Yes, miss. She went by here a few minutes ago, moving up the train. Should I have stopped her? She seemed very determined about something.
Maracy groaned. Steris must have slipped past while she was checking in the rooms of the second-class car. Frustrated, she took her rifle back and chased after her sister. Wax's metal reserves were gone. Wax knelt, completely stunned. This was impossible. How in Harmony's name? He twisted, discovering that the enormous bandit had stepped into this car. Doors rattled around the man, shaking as if someone were trying violently to get out. Wax ducked into the hallway and lifted his gun, but it was flipped from his fingers by a push. Immediately after, Wax himself was shoved backward by his gun belts. He slammed into the opposite wall of the car, right next to the closed door leading toward the back of the train. He groaned in pain.
How? How had they...
He shook his head, then heaved against the wall, using his breakaway buckles to rip free of his gun belts. He dropped to the floor, leaving his guns in the metal vial stuck to the wall as the brute loped toward him. Wax dodged onto the man's first swing and delivered a punch right into the man's side. It felt like punching a steel wall. He danced backward, but rusts, it had been years since he'd gotten into a real fist fight, and he was slower than he'd once been. The giant's next right hook caught him as he tried to jab for the face. His vision flashed, and his cheek erupted in pain. The blow shoved him into the side wall.
Rusts. Where was Wayne?
The brute came in again, and Wax dodged to the side, barely, and managed to connect with the man's face. Once, twice, three quick jabs. The brute smiled. Doors still rattled around him. He was a coin shot, obviously, pushing out with a bubble like the one Wax used. He'd even pressed a little on the metal mine's wax war on his upper arms, which were resistant to allomancy. This man could have ended the fight at any moment by grabbing a bit of metal and shooting it. He preferred the hand-to-hand fight. Indeed, the man raised his fists and nodded to Wax, still grinning, inviting him to come in for another round. To hell with that. Wax turned and slammed his shoulder against a door into an empty second-class compartment and made for the window.
Hey!
The man said behind him.
Hey!
Wax leaped at the window and increased his weight. He hit the window shoulder first, arms covering his face, and smashed through, then barely managed to catch the bottom window frame as he fell outside. Fingers dripping blood from the broken glass, he pulled himself up, stood on the windowsill, and scaled the outside of the train, finally heaving himself onto the roof. Wind rushed around him, and he was shocked to see that he wasn't alone up here. Ahead about 4 cars, a group of armed men pressed toward the front of the train, bearing something large and seemingly heavy. What in the name of the lost metal was that?
Hey!
The large bandit said again as he climbed the side of the car. Wax sighed, then kicked the man in the face as he tried to pull himself onto the top. The man growled. Wax kicked him again, then stomped on one of his hands. The man glared at Wax, then dropped back down to the window and climbed inside.
You can beat anybody, Wayne always said, so long as you don't let them fight back properly.
Wax moved to the center of the train car. He felt he should be chasing down those men up ahead, but he was unarmed now, and the coin shot below was bound to pester him.
You have what you wanted, he thought at the robbers. Why are you still fighting?
The brute's head appeared a moment later, peeking over the lip of the car's roof near the rear platform, which had a ladder. Wax rushed him, preparing to kick again, but the brute climbed up too quickly. He was holding something. One of Wax's gun belts. Damn! The man grinned, stepping onto the rooftop, pulling Renette's enormous shotgun out and dropping the gun belt. Beneath them, the train shot out of the forest and rolled toward an open bridge rising hundreds of feet above the river below. The brute raised the shotgun as if to fire from the hip.
Excellent.
Wax dove for the rooftop as the brute pulled the trigger, and the massive kick Renette had built into the gun took him entirely by surprise. The weapon ripped out of his fingers, jerking backward and falling down between the cars. The man howled, cradling his hand. Wax tackled him in the chest. The man grunted, stumbling backward, but caught himself before he toppled off the train. Wax didn't care. He was after the gun belt, which had fallen at the man's feet. He snatched it with his fingers still wet with blood. It held Renette's 2 cord devices, along with a single glorious metal vial. Wax yanked it out, tucking the gun belt into his waistband. However, the vial lurched in his fingers. He snatched it, holding on tightly, but the brute's push sent him backward across the train's roof in a skid. He slipped and fell to his knees, catching the side of the train. The coin shot kept pushing. Wax clung to the rooftop with his left hand, but his right arm, which held the metal vial, strained in its socket. The brute smiled and started walking forward. Each step closer let him push harder. Wax gritted his teeth. The cuts on his fingers were superficial, though they stung like hell, and the blood made his grip slippery. He struggled, trying to pull the vial toward his mouth, but failed. Renette's sphere devices. They hung from the gun belt tucked into his waist. Could he use those? How? Beneath him, the train started across the bridge. The thug advanced on Wax, rolling his shoulder and trying to make a fist despite his broken thumb. Behind the man, something moved on the ladder. A head coming up? Wayne! No! He saw the tip of a gun wave as the person climbed. Wayne wouldn't have a gun. Marcy? Steris appeared at the lip of the roof, wind blowing her hair wildly. She looked from the huge robber to Wax, then seemed to gasp, though the wind was too loud for Wax to hear it. She scrambled up and set herself, crouching on one knee, holding Renette's shotgun. Oh, no! Steris! He shouted. The brute spun, noticing her as she set the gun at her shoulder, wide-eyed, dress rippling against her body in the wind. She pulled the trigger. Unsurprisingly, the shot went wild, but it did manage to clip the brute in the arm, spraying blood. The man grunted, releasing his push on Wax. Unfortunately, the enormous kick of that gun, intended to be used to fight allomancers, hurled Steris backward, and right off the side of the train. 8. Wax leaped off the side of the train and raised the vial to his mouth. Steris toppled below, falling toward the river. He ripped the cork free with his teeth and turned over in the air, sucking down the contents of the vial. Cod liver oil and metal flakes washed into his mouth. Swallowing took a precious moment. Nothing. Nothing. Nothing.
Power.
Wax shouted, flaring steel and pushing on the tracks up above. He shot downward in a blur, slamming into Steris, grabbed her, and pushed on the shotgun that toppled beneath her. It hit the water. They slowed immediately. Water viscosity being what it was, you could push off something sinking. A second later, the shotgun hit the bottom of the churning river, and that left the two of them hanging about 2 feet above the water's surface. A faint, solitary blue line led from Wax to the shotgun. Steris breathed in short, frantic gasps. She clung to him, blinked, and then looked down at the river.
"What is wrong with that gun?" she said.
"It's meant for me to shoot," Wax said, "when my weight is increased to counteract the kick."
He looked up toward the disappearing train. It had crossed the river, but now it'd have to slow and chug its way down some switchbacks on a hill on the other side, coming out of the highlands to head on toward New Saren.
"Hold this," he told Steris, handing her his gun belt and removing the two spheres. "What were you thinking? I told you to stay back in the other car."
"As a point of fact," she said, "you did not. You told me to stay safe."
"So?"
"So it has been my experience that the safest place in a gunfight is near you, Lord Waxillium."
He grunted.
"Hold your breath."
"What? Why should I?"
She yelped as he pushed onto the steel bridge supports nearby, plunging them down into the river. Ice-cold water surrounded them as Wax kept pushing, plunging downward until he reached his gun, easily located by its blue line, settled into the muck on the bottom. Ears throbbing from the pressure, he snatched the gun, replacing it with one of Renette's sphere devices, then pushed. They popped back out of the river, trailing water, and Wax pushed them as high as his anchor would allow, and handed Steris the shotgun to hold. From there, he pushed off one of the support beams below, launching them upward and to the side. A push on one from the other direction sent them bounding upward the other way, and he was able to work them toward the top of the bridge. The angle of these pushes had sent them out away from the tracks, unfortunately. When they soared up past the bridge, he needed to sling Renette's other sphere device out, getting it into a small gap between bridge struts. He engaged the hooks so that the push from below, combined with a taut cord in his hand, swung him and Steris in an arc. He landed on the tracks, a soggy Steris in one arm, cord in the other. He could imagine Renette's grin as he told her how well the thing had worked. He disengaged the hooks and yanked the device back into his hand, though he had to wind the cord manually. Steris' teeth chattered audibly, and he glanced at her as he finished winding, expecting to see her frightened and miserable. Instead, despite being dripping wet, she had a stupid grin on her face, eyes alight with excitement. Wax couldn't help smiling himself as he stowed Renette's sphere and tied on his gun belt, then shoved his shotgun into the holster.
"Remember, you're not supposed to find things like that fun, Steris. You're supposed to be boring. I have it on good authority from this woman I know."
"A tone-deaf man," Steris said, "can still enjoy a good choir, even if he could never participate."
"Not buying the act, my dear," Wax said. "Not any longer. You just climbed on top of a moving train car and shot a bandit, rescuing your fiancé."
"It behooves a woman," she said, "to show an interest in her husband's hobbies. Though I suppose I should be outraged, as this is the second time you've dunked me in a very short period of time, Lord Waxillium."
"I thought you said the first one wasn't my fault."
"Yes, but this was twice as cold, so it evens out."
He smiled.
"You want to wait here, or join me?"
Join you?"
He nodded to the left. Far below, the train hit the end of its switchbacks down the hillside, leveling out to approach the final bend before heading southward. Her eyes opened wider, then she grabbed him in a tight grip.
"When we land," he said, "keep your head down and find a place to hide."
"Got it."
He took a deep breath, then launched himself high in a powerful arc through the night air. They sailed across the river, coming down like a bird of prey toward the front of the train. Wax slowed himself in Steris with a careful push on the engine, settling down atop the coal tender. Inside the cab, right in front of them, a bandit held a gun to the engineer's head. Wax let go of Steris, then spun around and pumped the shotgun, popping the expended shells into the air, and pushed on the shells, sending them through the back of the engine cab and right into the bandit's head. She dropped, falling on the engine controls. Wax was nearly thrown off as the train lurched, slowing down. He spun, grabbing Steris by the arm. To his right, the startled engineer grabbed the lever, smoothing out the deceleration. Holding Steris to him, Wax leaped with a short push into the open rear of the engine, where they landed beside the engineer and the dead bandit.
"What are they doing?"
he asked, dropping Steris, then kneeling and taking the dead bandit's pistol.
"They have some device,"
the engineer said, frantic, pointing.
"They're installing it between the coal tender and the first car. Shot my fireman when he tried to defend me, the bastards."
"Where's the next town?"
"Ironstand. We're getting close. Few more minutes."
"Get us there as quickly as you can and call for some surgeons and the local constables the moment we arrive." The man nodded frantically. Wax closed his eyes and took a deep breath to orient himself.
The final push. Here we go.
Halfway through the train, Marisi had reason to curse Waxillium Ladrian. Well, another reason. She added it to the list. Though she was supposed to be finding Steris, she spent most of her time being mobbed by worried passengers who needed soothing. Apparently the bandits had quickly worked their way through the second and third class cars, shaking people down for what little money they had. The people were terrified, upset, and looking for anyone with a hint of authority to comfort them. Marisi did her best, settling them onto benches, checking to see if any more people were seriously wounded. She helped bandage a young man who had stood up to a bandit, and now bore a shot in the side as a result. He might make it. Passengers had seen Steris come through here. Marisi tried to contain her worry and peeked into the next car in the line. It was deserted, save for one passenger standing calmly at the far end, cane in hand, blocking the passage. Marisi checked the various rooms as she entered, rifle held at the ready, but spotted no bandits. This was the last car before the cargo cars, which, oddly, were at the front of this train. This car's interior showed its share of bullet holes in the woodwork, suggesting Waxillium had been here.
"Sir?"
Marisi asked, hastening to the lone man. He was slender and younger than she'd expected him to be from behind, considering how his posture slumped, and how he relied upon the cane to keep him upright.
"Sir, it's not safe for you here. You should move to the rear cars."
He turned toward her with raised eyebrows.
"I am always inclined to obey the wishes of a pretty woman," he said.
She could see that he kept one hand stiff at his side, fingers closed as if clutching something.
"But what of you, miss? Is there no danger to you?"
"I can care for myself,"
Marisi said, noting that the next car in line was crowded with corpses. She felt sick.
"Indeed," the man said. "You look quite capable. Quite capable indeed."
He leaned in.
"Are you more than you appear, perhaps? A metal-born?"
Marisi frowned at the odd question. She'd taken a dose of cadmium, of course, for all the good it would do. Her allomancy was generally something to laugh at. She could slow down time in a bubble around herself, which meant speeding it up for everyone else. A wonderful power if you were bored and waiting for the play to start. But it wasn't of so much use in combat, where you'd be left frozen in place while your enemies could escape or just set themselves up to shoot you when the bubble dropped. True, she could make the bubble fairly large, so she could catch others inside of it, but that would still leave her trapped, and likely with hostiles. The man smiled at her, then abruptly raised his hand, the one that appeared to be clutching something. Marisi started to react, bringing her rifle up. But at that moment the train unexpectedly lurched, slowing as if someone had leaned on the brake. The man cursed, stumbling and slamming into the wall before falling to the floor. Marisi caught herself, but dropped the rifle. She looked at the man, who regarded her with wide eyes before maladroitly stumbling to his feet. One of his legs didn't work right, and hastening out of the train car onto the platform, slamming the door behind him. Marisi stared after him, confused. She'd assumed he was pulling a gun on her, but that hadn't been the case at all. The object had been far too small. She reached for her gun, and beside it on the floor, she was surprised to find a small metal cube with bizarre symbols on it. Gunfire sounded ahead. Marcy tucked the curiosity away and shouldered her rifle, determined to find Waxillium and, hopefully, her stupid sister. Eyes closed, Wax felt the metal burning. That fire, comfortable and familiar. Metal was his soul. Compared to it, the chill of the river was no more than a raindrop on a bonfire. He felt the gun in his fingers, a bandit's gun, unfamiliar to him. Yet he knew it by the lines pointing at its barrel, trigger, levers, the bullets inside. 5 shots left. He could see them, even with his eyes closed. Go. He opened his eyes and leaped out of the engine, pushing himself forward in a rush. He passed over the coal tender, then burst into the first cargo car, laden with mail and heaping sacks, and passed through in a tempest. He skidded out onto its rear platform and pushed to either side, launching 2 bandit guards upward and outward, 1 in each direction. The train ran up beside the river here. Trees blurred past on the left, water on the right. Wax launched himself upward onto the top of the 2nd cargo car, noting the bandits with their device here. Another, larger group had gathered atop the next car, the one they'd robbed. Wax fired with cold precision, killing the 3 bandits. He stepped up to the device the engineer had mentioned, which was nothing more than a large case of dynamite and a trigger linked to a clock. Wax ripped the detonator off, tossed it aside, then pushed the entire box away to be sure. It plunged into the river. Something pushed his gun out of his hand. He spun, finding the large bandit from before lumbering toward him across the roof. He'd left a larger group of bandits on the next rooftop over. You again, Wax thought with a growl, dropping his gun belt, but resting his foot on it to keep it from blowing away. The man came running toward Wax. With the brute very close, Wax knelt and yanked out Renette's sphere device. The bandit pushed on that, of course, causing the sphere to leap backward to the side. Wax kept a firm hold on the cord, wrapping it with a yank around the bandit's leg. The bandit stared down in confusion. Wax pushed, shoving the sphere into a batch of trees, engaging its hooks. I believe this is your stop. The large man suddenly flew off the train, yanked by the cord, which was now hooked to a tree. Wax picked up his gun belt and advanced on the larger group of bandits, wind whipping around him on the rooftop. He was facing down at least 12 of them, and he had no weapon. Fortunately, the group was busy throwing one of their members off the train? Wax blinked in surprise, but that was indeed what they were doing. They tossed one of the bandits overboard. It was the man with the cane, who hit the water beside the train with a splash. A group of the others started to follow suit, leaping into the river. One spotted Wax pointing. 6 remaining bandits leveled weapons. Then froze. Wax hesitated, the wind at his back. The men didn't move, didn't flinch, didn't even blink. Wax hopped across to the next car, then took a cork from his pocket, from one of his vials, and tossed it toward the men. It hit some invisible barrier and froze there, hanging in the air. Wax grinned, then dropped down between the cars and pushed into the one the men were standing on. There, he found Marcy standing atop a bunch of suitcases, her shoulders pressed against the train's ceiling, just below the men so she could engage a speed bubble and freeze them all in place. 9. Wax had never shot a doctor before, but he did like trying out new experiences. Perhaps today would be the day. I'm fine, he growled as the woman dabbed with cotton at the wound on his face where the massive brute had punched him. His lip had split.
I'll decide that, she said.
Nearby, the iron stand constables marched 4 befuddled bandits along the train platform, which was flooded with light from a few tall arc lamps. Wax sat on a bench near where the other surgeons were attending to the wounded. Farther back, in the shadows of the night, a tarp covered the bodies they'd retrieved. There were far too many of those.
It looks worse than it is, Wax said.
You had blood all over your face, my lord.
I wiped my forehead with a bloody hand.
She had wrapped that hand with gauze already, but had agreed that the cuts were superficial. Finally, she stepped back and sighed, nodding. Wax stood up, grabbing his damp suit coat and striding toward the train. He saw Marcy peering out of the front. She shook her head. No sign of Wayne or Milan. The lump inside Wax's stomach grew two sizes.
Wayne'll be fine, he told himself. He can heal from practically anything.
But there were ways to kill a blood maker. A shot to the back of the head. Prolonged suffocation. Basically anything that would have forced Wayne to keep healing until his ferrochemical storages ran out. And of course, there was the other thing. The strange effect that had somehow stolen Wax's allomantic powers. If that had worked on ferrochemy, too. Wax strode onto the train, stepping past Marcy without saying a word, and started his own search. The train was dark, now that it had stopped, and the only lights came from the platform outside.
There wasn't much to see by.
Lord Wexilium?
Constable Mathieu said, sticking his head in between two of the cars. The spindly man had a ready smile, which fell off his face as Wax bustled past.
Busy, Wax said, entering the next car.
Blue lines let him see sources of metal even in the darkness. Wayne would be carrying metal vials and his bracers.
Look for faint sources of metal, hidden behind something. Perhaps they just knocked him out and stuffed him somewhere.
The constable said from behind. I was wondering if any of your other servants will be needing, emotional support?
Wax frowned, looking out the window to where Druten was sitting, surrounded by no fewer than three nurses. He accepted a cup of tea from one while he complained about his ordeal. Wax could hear it even inside the train car.
No, Wax said. Thank you.
Mathieu followed him through the train. He was the local captain, though from what Wax gathered, this town was small enough that his big cases usually were on the order of who had been stealing Mrs. Hutchins' milk off her doorstep. He was glad to have found surgeons. Most of them probably worked half their time on cows, but it was better than nothing.
Not a few younger officers stood on the platform. They put away their stupid autograph books, fortunately, though they seemed deflated that their captain wouldn't let them pester Wax.
Where? Wax thought, feeling more and more sick.
Marcy arrived a moment later with an oil lamp, her light illuminating the train car for him as he poked through a cargo room full of mailbags.
He won't be in here, Wax thought.
This was forward of the car that had been secretly carrying the payroll shipment. Wayne wouldn't have been able to cross through that one. They'd have had it blocked off even before the bandits arrived. Still, he wanted to be careful. He searched this one, then waved to Marcy and picked his way through the wreckage of the car that had been robbed. Mathieu tagged along.
I have to say, Lord Wexilium, that we're very lucky you were aboard. The Night Street gang has been growing bolder and bolder, but I never thought they'd try something like this.
So this is an established gang? Marcy said.
Oh, sure, Mathieu said. Everyone in the area knows about the Night Streets, though mostly they hit cities closer to the roughs. We figure it's slim pickings out past the mountains, so they have begun to venture inward.
But this? A full-on train robbery? And stealing Erikel payroll? That's daring. Those folks make weapons, you know.
They had at least one allomancer with them, Wax said, leading the way through the empty courier car, which still smelled faintly of formaldehyde.
I hadn't heard that, Mathieu said. Even luckier you were along.
I didn't stop them from getting away or from stealing the payroll.
You killed or captured a good half of them, my lord. The ones we've got, they'll give us a lead on the others.
He hesitated.
We'll have to put together a posse, my lord. They'll be making for the roughs. Sure could use your help.
Wax swept this room, focusing on the blue lines.
And the man with the limp?
My lord?
He seemed to be in charge of them, Wax said. A man in a fine suit who walked with a cane. About 6 feet tall, with a narrow face and dark hair. Who is he?
I don't know that one, my lord. Donnie is the leader.
Big guy? Wax asked. Neck like a stump?
No, my lord. Donnie is little and feisty. Evilest rusting kig you've ever seen.
Kig? It was slang for a Kolos-blooded person. Wax hadn't seen anyone among the bandits with the proper skin color for that.
Thank you, Captain, Wax said.
The man seemed to recognize it as a dismissal, but he hesitated.
And can we count on your help, my lord, when we chase down Donnie and his gang? I'll let you know.
Mathieu saluted, which was completely inappropriate. Wax wasn't part of this jurisdiction, and retreated. Wax continued searching, pulling open a luggage compartment beneath the first passenger car. The metal lines leading into it only pointed at a few pieces of baggage.
Waxillium, Marcy said. You can't help with their hunt. We have a job already.
Might be related.
Might not be, she said. You heard him, Waxillium. These guys are a known criminal element.
Who happened to rob the very train we were on.
But at the same time seemed utterly shocked by the presence of an Allomancer gunman in the last car. Instead of tossing dynamite at us and riddling the coach with bullets, they sent a couple men to rob what they assumed would be easy pickings.
Wax chewed on that, then checked another luggage compartment, bracing himself as he did so. No bodies. He let out a breath.
I can't think about this right now, he said.
She nodded in understanding. They checked the other compartments, and he didn't see any suspicious lines, so they moved on. Crossing the space between cars, he spotted Steris watching him. She sat alone on a bench with a blanket around her shoulders, holding a cup of something that steamed. She seemed perfectly calm. He continued on. Losing friends was part of a lawman's life. It happened to him more times than he wanted to count. But after what had happened back in the city 6 months ago, well, he wasn't sure what losing Wayne would do to him. He steeled himself, moved to the next car, and opened the first of its luggage compartments, then froze. Faint steel lines coming from another place in this train car. They were moving. Wax rushed toward them. Marcy followed, suddenly alert, her lamp held high. The lines were coming from the floor inside one of the rooms. Only no luggage was on its racks, and no litter was on its floor. It was a private compartment that hadn't been rented out for the trip. Wax entered and ripped open the luggage compartment in the floor. Wayne blinked up at him. The younger man had mussed hair and his shirt was unbuttoned, but he wasn't in any bonds that Wax could see. He didn't seem to have been harmed at all. In fact, Wax crouched down, Marcy's light revealing what had been hidden to him by the overhang of the luggage compartment. Milan, shirt completely off, was in the compartment too. She sat up, entirely unashamed of her nudity.
We stopped, she said. Are we there already?
Well, how was I supposed to know we'd get rusting attacked? Wayne exclaimed, now more properly clothed, though his hair was still a mess.
Wax sat listening with half an ear. The train officials had opened a room in the station for them to use. He knew he should be angry, but he was mostly just relieved.
Because we are us, Marcy said, arms folded. Because we're on our way to a dangerous situation. I don't know. You could at least have told us what you were doing.
She hesitated.
And by the way, what do you think you were doing?
Wayne bowed his head where he sat before her. Milan leaned against the wall near the door. She was looking toward the ceiling, as if trying to feign innocence.
Moving on, Wayne said, pointing at Marcy. Like you told me to. That wasn't moving on. That was running on at full speed. It was shooting on forward like a bullet, Wayne. I don't like doing stuff halfway, he said solemnly, hand over his heart. It's been a long time since I had me a good neckin', on account of my diligent monogamous idealization of a beauteous but unavailable. And how, Marcy interrupted, did you not hear the fight? There was gunfire, Wayne, practically on top of you. Well, see, he said, growing red. We was real busy. And we were down next to the tracks, which made a lot of noise. We'd wanted a place what was private like, you know, and... He shrugged.
Bah! Marcy said. Do you realize how worried Waxillium was?
Don't bring me into this, Wax said, seated with his feet up on the next bench.
Oh, and you approve of this behavior? Marcy asked, turning on him.
Heavens no, Wax said. If I approved of half the things Wayne does, Harmony would probably strike me dead on the spot. But he's alive, and we're alive, and we can't blame him for getting distracted during what we assumed would be a simple ride.
Marcy eyed him, then sighed and walked back out onto the platform, passing me lawn without a glance. Wayne stood and wandered over to him, pulling his box of gum from his pocket and tapping it against his palm to settle the powder inside.
These thieves. Did one of them happen to shoot her when you weren't looking? 'Cause she's sure gotten stiff all of a sudden.
She was just worried about you, Wax said. I'll talk to her after she's cooled down.
Milan left her position by the door.
Was there anything strange about the attack?
Plenty of things, Wax said, standing and stretching. Rusts. Was he really getting too old for all this, as Lessie always joked with him? He usually felt exhilarated after a fight.
It's the deaths, he thought.
Only one passenger had died, an older man, but they'd lost half a dozen payroll guards, not to mention the many wounded.
One of the bandits, he said to Milan. He did something that dampened my allomancy.
A leecher?
She asked. Wax shook his head.
He didn't touch me.
Leechers who burned chromium could blank another allomancer's metals, but it required touch.
It did feel the same. My steel was there one moment, then gone the next. But Milan, there was some kind of device involved. A little metal cube.
Wait,
a voice said. Marcy appeared in the doorway.
A cube?
All three of them looked at her, and she blushed in the harsh electric light.
What?
You stalked away, Wayne pointed. Indigenously.
And now I'm stalking back in,
Marcy said, striding toward Wax and fishing in her pocket.
I can be indignant in here, just as easily.
She pulled her hand out, holding a small metal cube. The same cube he'd seen before his steel was drained. Wax plucked it from her palm.
Where'd you get this?
The guy with the cane dropped it, Marcy said. He moved as if to pull a gun on me and raised this.
Wax turned it toward Milan, and she shook her head.
That's a real strange gun, Wayne noted.
Is there anything in that lore Vendel talked about, Wax said, that mentions a device that negates allomancy?
Nothing I've heard, Milan said.
I mean, Wayne said, it ain't even got a barrel.
But you said you don't pay attention to the research, Milan, Marcy said, taking the cube back.
That's true.
And if they could shoot the rustin' thing, Wayne added, the bullet would be small as a flea.
Marcy sighed.
Wayne, can't you ever let a joke die?
Hon, that joke started dead, he said. I'm just giving it a proper burial.
We need another train south,
Marcy said, turning to the others.
These bandits might have information, Wayne said. Chasing them down could be useful. Sides, I didn't get to stomp none of them, on account of some untimely snogging.
At least it was good snogging,
Milan added. Then to Marcy's glare she added,
What? It was. Poor guy hadn't had a proper snog in years. Had a lot of pent-up energy.
You're not even human, Marcy said. You should be ashamed. Not to mention that you're 600 years old.
I'm young at heart. Really. I copied this one off a 16-year-old that I ate a few months back.
The room grew very still.
Oh, was that gauche?
Milan said, wincing.
That was gauche, wasn't it? She didn't taste very good, if that's anything to you. Hardly rotten at all, and... I should stop talking about this. New Saren, are we going or staying to chase bandits?
Going, Wax said, which earned a nod from Maracy. If this is connected, we'll run into them later. If it's not, then I'll see what I can do to help once we've dealt with my uncle.
And how are we going to get to New Saren? Wayne said. Doesn't look like our train will be leaving any time soon.
Freight train, Wax said, checking the wall lists. Coming through in an hour. They're going to move our train onto the repair track so we can flag that one down for a ride. It won't be comfortable, but it will get us there by morning. Go gather your luggage. Hopefully there aren't too many holes in it.
Wayne and Milan obeyed, walking out side by side. Maybe there was actually something there between them. If anything, Wayne didn't seem the least bit put out by being reminded just how alien and just how old Milan was. Then again, Wayne wasn't known for his taste in women. Or, well, his taste at all, really. Wax glanced at Maracy, who had remained behind. She held up the little cube, turning it over in her fingers, inspecting the intricate carvings it bore on its various faces.
"Can I get Vendel's notes back from you?" she said. "Maybe there's something in them about this thing."
More convinced this wasn't a random train robbery?
"Maybe a little," Maracy said. "You should talk to my sister."
"She seemed perfectly calm when I checked on her earlier."
"Of course she's calm," Maracy said. "She's Steris. But she's also doing needlework."
"And that's bad?"
"Steris only does needlework when she has an overwhelming desire to appear normal," Maracy said. "She read somewhere that it's an appropriate hobby for a woman of means. She hates it to death, but won't tell a soul. Trust me, if needlework is involved, she's upset. I could talk to her, but she's never listened to me. She didn't even know about me until we were teenagers. Besides, you'll need to get used to this." She strode from the room, and Wax, oddly, found himself smiling. Whatever else could be said, Maracy had come a long way since he'd first met her. He took his jacket off the hook on the wall and slipped it on, then walked back into the night. Maracy was calling for the station master, probably to arrange their passage on the cargo train. Wax strolled along the tracks, passing cold electric lights until he reached the bench where Steris worked on her needlepoint. He settled down beside her.
"Maracy says you're having a tough time of it."
Steris paused her needlepoint.
"You're a very straightforward man, Lord Waxillium."
"Can be."
"As we both know, it's all an act. You were raised among Elendel's elite. You had tutors and diction coaches. In your youth, you spent your time at parties and balls."
"And then I spent 20 years in the roughs," Wax said. "The winds out there can weather the strongest granite. Are you surprised they can do the same to a man?"
She turned to him, head cocked to the side. Wax sighed and leaned back, stretching his legs out, ankles crossed.
"Have you ever been somewhere you didn't fit in? A place where everyone else seems to get it immediately? They know what to do. They know what to say. But Rosts, you have to work to untangle it all."
"That describes my entire life," Steris said softly.
He put his arm around her and let her rest her head on his shoulder.
"Well, that's how those parties were for me. Social situations were a chore. Everyone laughing, and me just standing there, stressed out of my mind and trying to figure out the right thing to do. I didn't smile a lot back then. Guess I still don't. I'd escape the parties when I could, find my way to a quiet balcony."
"And do what? Read?"
Wax chuckled.
"No. I don't mind a book now and then, but Wayne is the real reader."
Steris raised her head, looking surprised.
"I'm serious," Wax said. "Granted, he likes the ones with pictures now and then, but he does read. Often out loud. You should hear him do the voices to himself." "Me? I'd just find a balcony that looked out over the city somewhere, and I'd stare. Listen."
He smiled.
"When I was a boy, more than a few people thought I was slow because I'd sit there staring out a window."
"Then you found your way to the roughs."
I was so glad to be away from Ellendale and its phoniness. You call me blunt. Well, that's the man I want to be. That's the man I admire. Perhaps I'm only acting like him, but it's a sincere act. Hang me, but it is.
Styris sat quietly for a few moments, head on his shoulder, and Wax stared out into the night. A nice night, all things considered.
You're wrong,
she noted, sounding drowsy.
You do smile. Most often when you're flying on lines of steel. It's the only time I think I see pure joy in you.
He looked down at her, but she'd apparently dozed off, judging by the way she was breathing. He settled back, thinking about what she'd said, until the cargo train finally pulled into the station. Upper right quadrant of the new Ascendancy broadsheet. Does Harmony have a metal? The First Age philosopher, Galabras Menthon, meant this rhetorically, but even the Lord Mistborn thought on this when he famously said, "Having the Has-Sazed a metal?" From councils to pubs, the question is still debated, but now breakthroughs in science have brought us closer to an answer. Continued on back. Farthing Mansion hit. An act of vandalism and thievery has the city's elite on edge. Late last night, someone broke into Farthing Mansion, stole some items, and vandalized the wall with a reverse gold symbol. Lady Farthing is offering a reward for the return of her jewelry. Please report all information to the Uptown Precinct. Continued on back. The mark of the vandal, the reverse gold symbol. Workers unite. Enormous mass meeting tonight at 7th hour at the crossing of Emble and 5th. Stand up to unfair taxes, low wages. Soother's Choice Chewing Gum. Stick it to the Dell and buy local. Soother's Choice is the only choice.
10.
Wax started awake to the sound of distant explosions. He immediately scrambled to his feet, reaching for his medals, bleary-eyed and disoriented. Where was he? Crew cabin of the cargo train. It was large, with some stiff couches in the back for the engineers to catch a nap while their train was waiting to be unloaded. Styris was asleep on one, wrapped in his jacket. Wayne dozed in the corner, hat over his face. They'd left the servants behind for now. They would come along on the next passenger train. Milan had chosen to ride in the back with their luggage. She had wanted to look through her bundles of bones to pick the right body for the night. Wax downed medals and whipped out Vindication, stumbling forward toward the sounds, which, now fully awake, he wasn't certain were explosions at all. A continuous rumble, like an earthquake, off in the distance. He stepped out into the cab proper of the engine car. This was a newer machine, one of the oil-driven ones, with no need for a coal tender. Maracy stood near the front with the engineer, a tall fellow with bright eyes and forearms like pistons. That rumbling. Wax frowned, lowering his gun as Maracy glanced at him. The sky was bright blue. Morning had arrived. He stepped into the cabin and could see that ahead New Saren rose before them. The city spread across a series of enormous, flat-topped stone terraces. There were at least a dozen of them, and each was split by multiple streams which crossed them and then dropped off the edge down to the next terrace. The sound wasn't an earthquake or explosion, but that of waterfalls. In places, the drop was just a ripple, a fall of some 5 feet or so. But in others, majestic waterfalls plunged 50 feet or more before pounding onto the next stone platform. It looked like a man-made effect, for the various split streams and waterfalls eventually ran back together into the river, which flowed away from the city toward distant Ellendale. Wax slid Vindication into her holster, though it took 2 tries because he was so mesmerized by the waterfalls. Indeed, the whole city. Buildings sprouted between the rivers, and vibrant green vines draped the cliffs like nature's own trellises. Beyond, the Saren Mountains rose, lofty and whited at the tops. Marcy grinned, leaning out of the cab to get a better look up at the heights of the city. The engineer stood by his levers, valves, and cranks, trying to act casual, though he was obviously watching Wax and Marcy for their reactions.
"I often think," the man eventually said, "that Harmony was showing off a little when he made this place."
"I had no idea this was here," Wax said, stepping up beside Marcy.
Behind him, Wayne yawned and stumbled to his feet.
"Yeah, well," the engineer said, "people from Ellendale often forget there's a whole country out here. No offense, my lord. There's a lot of Ellendale to take in, so it makes sense you'd get a little blinded by it."
"You're from New Saren?" Marcy asked.
"Born and raised, Captain Combs."
"Then you can tell us where to find our hotel, perhaps?" Marcy asked. "The Copper Gate?"
"Oh, that's a nice one," the engineer said, pointing. "Top terrace, in the Waterman District. Look for the big statue of the Lord Mistborn. It's not two blocks from there."
"How close can you get us?" Marcy asked.
"Not close at all, I'm afraid," the engineer said. "We're not a passenger train, and even those can only go to the middle tiers. We'll be down at the bottom. It'll take you a few hours to ride the gondolas up. There are ramps, too, if you'd prefer a carriage, but they take longer. And the gondolas have a better view."
Gondolas would have been wonderful, Wax thought, if most of them had had more than a few hours of sleep. With the reception tonight, they'd need to be rested and ready to go.
"Shortcut?" he asked Marcy.
"You realize I'm wearing a skirt?"
"I do. What happened to that fancy new constable uniform with the trousers?"
"Packed away. Not everyone likes wearing uniforms when we don't have to, Waxillium."
"Well, you can wait and take the gondolas," Wax said. "Think of me resting peacefully in a soft hotel bed while you blink bleary eyes and droop against—"
"All right, fine," Marcy said, stepping up to him. "Just stay away from the crowds."
Wax grabbed her around the waist.
"I'll be back for the rest of you," he told Wayne, who nodded.
"Engineer, have our things sent to the Copper Gate, if you please."
"Yes, my lord."
Wax slid open the side of the cab, took another drink of metal flakes, recovered from the stash in his luggage, then pulled Marcy tight, burned steel, and leaped. A flared push sent them soaring away from the train, which was slowing as it approached the buildings clustered around the base of New Saren. They dropped toward these, but a shot from Vindication as they neared the ground gave him something to bounce off of. He sent them upward, past the lower tiers, using metal he found there to keep them aloft. The homes here were much smaller than those in Ellendale. Quaint, even. In Ellendale, you could rarely afford to waste space on a single dwelling. Even in the slums, towering apartments were the norm. There was a kind of eternal shift going on, where sections of town would fall into disrepair over time, filling with the poor, while those able to afford something new moved to other sections. It was fascinating to him that, if you looked at old maps, what were now slums had once been considered prime real estate. He saw few apartment buildings and only three skyscrapers confined to a small commercial district on the top terrace. Though the terraces constrained the city's boundaries, they looked large enough to hold the population. Lots of parks and small streams, none deep enough to be navigable like Ellendale's canals. He stayed to the rooftops rather than the streets, for Marcy's sake, though she didn't have much trouble with her skirt. She'd tucked it around her legs before they started, and the generally upward motion kept it from flaring. Wax threw the two of them in great leaping arcs over residential areas until they reached the next cliff face, where he found a gondola and used it as an anchor to shoot them up the 50 feet or so toward the top tier of the terraces. He exulted in the moment, the freedom, the beauty of it. There was a majesty about soaring alongside a churning waterfall, with sparkling pools and lush gardens spreading out beneath. They topped the cliff face, and Wax landed them softly alongside the falls. Marcy let out a held breath as he set her down. He could tell from the tension of her grip that she hadn't enjoyed the flight as much as he had. Steel pushing wasn't natural to her, nor were the heights. She backed away from the cliff as soon as she was free.
"Going to get the others?" she asked.
"Let's find the hotel first," Wax said,
pointing the way toward a statue he'd spotted upon landing. He could still make out the green patina of the statue's head over the tops of the nearby homes. He started in that direction. Marcy joined him, and they entered a street with a fair amount of foot traffic. Paper girls and boys hawking broadsheets at every corner. Fewer horses or carriages than in Ellendale, almost none, though he did see a fair number of pedicabs. That made sense with the layout of the city. He found it interesting that the gondola system wasn't only for getting between terraces. There were also lines crossing the sky above them, carting people from one section of this terrace to another.
"Like a shark among minnows," Marcy mumbled.
"What's that?" Wax asked.
"Look at how people swerve around you," Marcy said. "Lord Seminus once did a study comparing constables to sharks, showing how the people in a crowded walkway responded exactly the same way as animals do to a predator moving nearby."
He hadn't noticed, but she was right. People gave him a wide berth, though not because they guessed he was a constable. It was the mistcoat duster, the weapons, and perhaps his height. Everyone seemed a little shorter down here, and he saw over the crowd by several inches. In Ellendale, his clothing had been abnormal. But so was everyone's. That city was a mishmash, like an old barrel full of spent cartridges, all different calibers represented. Here the people wore lighter clothing than in Ellendale. Pastel dresses for the ladies, striped white suits and boater hats for the men. Compared to them, he was a bullet hole in a stained glass window. "Never been good at blending in anyway," he said.
"Fair enough," Marcy said. "I've been meaning to ask. Do you need Wayne tonight?"
"At the party?" Wax asked, amused. "I have trouble imagining a situation where he doesn't end up drunk in the punch bowl."
"Then I'll borrow him," Marcy said. "I want to check the graveyards for Relure's spike."
Wax grunted. "That will be dirty work."
"Which is why I asked for Wayne."
"Noted. What do you think the chances are you'll find the thing buried in a grave?" Marcy shrugged.
"I figure we'll start with the most obvious and easiest method."
"Grave robbing is the easiest method?"
"It is with proper preparation," Marcy said. "I don't intend to do the digging, after all."
Wax stopped listening. The chatter of the crowd faded as he froze in place, staring at a broadsheet held up by a paper girl on a nearby corner. That symbol, the jagged reverse maw. He knew that symbol all too well. He left Marcy mid-sentence, pushing through the crowd to the girl and snatching the paper.
That symbol. Impossible.
"Farthing Mansion hit," the headline read. He fished out a few clips for the girl. "Farthing Mansion? Where is it?"
"Just up Blossom Way,"
the girl said, pointing with her chin and making the coins in his palm disappear. "Come on," he said, interrupting Marcy as she started saying something. People did make way for him, which was convenient. He could have taken to the sky, but he found the mansion without difficulty, partially because of the people crowded outside and pointing. The symbol was painted in red, exactly like the one he'd known back in the roughs. But this time it marred the wall of a fine three-story stone mansion instead of a stagecoach.
"Waxillium, for the love of sanity," Marcy said, catching up to him. "What has gotten into you?"
He pointed at the symbol.
"I recognize that," Marcy said. "Why would I recognize that?"
"You read the accounts of my time in the roughs," Wax said. "It's in there. That's the symbol of Ape Manton, one of my old nemeses."
"Ape Manton?" Marcy said. "Didn't he—"
"Yes," Wax said, remembering the nights of torture. "He hunts allomancers." "But why would he be here? Wax had put him away, and not just in some minor village. He'd been locked up in True Metal, biggest town in the northern roughs, with a jail like a vice. How in Harmony's true name had he gotten all the way down to New Saren? Robbery wouldn't be the end of Manton's activities here. He always had a motive behind the thefts, a goal. I have to figure out what he took and why he—" "No.
No, not right now. Let's get to the hotel, Wax said, ripping himself away from the sight of that red symbol.
Rusts, Maracy said, hurrying after him. Could he be involved somehow?
With the set? Not a chance. He hates allomancers.
Enemy of my enemy?
Not the ape, Wax said. He wouldn't take the hand of a metalborn trying to save him from slipping to his death.
So
he's not part of this, Wax said. We ignore him. I'm here for my uncle.
Maracy nodded, but seemed disturbed. They passed a lurcher juggler, dropping balls and tugging them back up into the air, along with the occasional object from among the amused crowd of watchers. A waste of allomantic abilities. And all these people. Suffocating. He had hoped that in leaving Ellendale, he would escape crowded streets. He nearly pulled out his gun and fired a shot to clear them all away.
Wax, Maracy said, taking his arm.
What?
What? Rust, your stare could nail a person's head to the wall right now.
I'm fine, he said, pulling his arm away from her.
This vendetta against your uncle is...
It's not a vendetta. Wax picked up his pace, striding through the crowd, mistcoat tassels flaring behind him. You know what he's doing.
No, and neither do you, Maracy said.
He's breeding allomancers, Wax said. Maybe ferrochemists. I don't need to know his exact plan to know how bad that is. What if he's making an army of thugs and coinshots? Twinborn. Compounders.
That might be true, Maracy admitted. But you aren't chasing him because of any of that, are you? He beat you. In the Hundred Lives case, Mr. Suit got the best of you. Now you're going to win the war where you lost the battle.
He stopped in place, turning on her.
How petty do you think I am? Considering what I just told you, she said, I'd say I consider you precisely that petty. It's not wrong to be angry at Suit, Waxillium. He's holding your sister. But Rusts, please don't let it cloud your judgment.
He took a deep breath, then gestured toward the mansion up the street. You want me to go chasing after the ape instead?
No, Maracy said, then blushed. I agree that we need to stay focused on getting back the spike.
You're here for the spike, Maracy, Wax said. I'm here to find Suit.
He nodded down the street toward a discreet hotel sign barely visible on the front of a building.
You go check us in. I'm going to fetch the others.
With this suite and the others, you'll basically have the entire top floor to yourselves. The hotel owner, who insisted upon being called Aunt Jin, beamed as she said it. Wayne yawned, rubbing his eyes as he poked through the lavish room's bar.
Right, lovely. Can I have your hat?
My hat?
The elderly woman looked up at the oversized hat. The sides drooped magnificently, and the thing was festooned with flowers, like oodles of them. Silk, he figured, but they were really good replicas.
You have a lady friend? Aunt Jin asked. You wish to give her the hat?
Nah, Wayne said. I need to wear it next time I'm an old lady.
The next time you... What?
Aunt Jin grew pale, but that was probably on account of the fact that Wax went stomping by, wearing his full rusting mist coat. That man never could figure out how to blend in.
Do these windows open?
Wax asked, pointing toward the penthouse suite's enormous bay windows. He stepped up onto one of the sofas and shoved on the window.
Well, they used to open, Aunt Jin said, but they rattled in the breezes, so we painted them shut and sealed the latches. Never could stand the thought of someone.
Wax shoved one of them open, breaking off the latch and making a sharp cracking sound as the paint outside ribbed because of some of the wood splintering.
Lord Ladrian,
Aunt Jin said with a gasp.
I'll pay for the repairs, Wax said, hopping off the couch. I need that to open in case I have to jump out.
Jump?
Aha,
Wayne said, pulling open the bar's bottom cabinet.
Alcohol?
Maracy asked, walking by.
Peanuts,
Wayne said, spitting out his gum and then popping a handful of nuts into his mouth.
I ain't had nothing to eat since I swiped that fruit in Steris's luggage.
What are you babbling about?
Steris asked from the couch, where she was writing in her notebook.
I left you one of my shoes in trade, Wayne said, then dug in his duster's pocket, pulling out the other shoe. Speaking of that, Jin, will you swap me your hat for this one?
Your shoe?
Aunt Jin asked, turning back toward him, then jumping as Wax forced open another window.
Sure,
Wayne said.
They're both clothes, right? What would I do with a man's shoe?
Wear it the next time you gotta be a fella, Wayne said. You've got the perfect face for it. Good shoulders, too.
Well, I...
Please ignore him, Steris said, rising and walking over.
Here, I've prepared for you a list of possible scenarios that might transpire during our residence here.
Steris, Wax said, forcing open the third and final window.
What?
She demanded.
I will not have the staff unprepared. Their safety is our concern.
Fire?
Aunt Jin asked, reading the list.
Shootouts, robbery, hostage situations, explosions?
That one is completely unfair, Wax said. You've been listening to Wayne.
Things do explode round you, mate,
Wayne said, munching peanuts. Nice bit of salt on these.
He's right, unfortunately, Steris said. I've accounted for 17 explosions involving you. That's a huge statistical anomaly, even considering your profession.
You're kidding. 17?
Afraid so.
Huh. He had the decency to look proud of it, at least.
A pastry shop once blew up while we was in it, Wayne said, leaning into Aunt Jin. Dynamite in the cake. Big mess.
He held out some peanuts toward her.
How about I throw in these peanuts with the shoe? Those are my peanuts, from this very room.
But they're worth more now, Wayne said, on account of my being real hungry.
I told you to ignore him,
Steris said, tapping on the notebook she'd handed Aunt Jin.
Look, you only read the table of contents. The rest of the pages contain explanations of the possible scenarios I've outlined and suggested responses to them. I've sorted the list by potential property damage.
Wax leaped into the center of the room, then thrust his hand forward. The door quivered.
What is he doing?
Aunt Jin asked.
Checking to see the best places in the room are for slamming the door with his mind, Wayne said. In case someone bursts in on us. Just read the notebook, all right?
Steris requested in a pleasant tone. Aunt Jin looked toward her, seeming bewildered.
Are these things threats? No, of course not, Steris said. I just want you to be prepared.
She's thorough, Wayne said.
I like to be thorough.
Usually that means if you ask her to kill a fly, she'll burn down the house just to be extra sure it gets done.
Wayne, Steris said, you're needlessly making the lady concerned. Flooding from a diverted waterfall,
Aunt Jin said, reading from the book again.
Coloss attack? Cattle stampede through the lobby? That one is highly unlikely, Steris said, but it never hurts to be prepared. But...
The door to the adjoining suite slammed open.
Hello, humans,
Milan said, stepping into the doorway, wearing nothing more than a tight pair of shorts and a cloth wrapped around her chest.
I need to put on something appropriate for tonight. What do you think? Large breasts? Small breasts? Extra large breasts?
Everybody in the room paused, then turned toward her.
What?
Milan said.
Picking a proper bust size is vital to a lady's evening preparations.
Silence.
That's kind of an improper question, Milan, Steris finally said.
You're just jealous because you can't take yours off to go for a run,
Milan said.
Hey, where is that bellboy with my things? I swear if he drops my bags and cracks any of my skulls, there will be fury in this room.
She stalked away.
Did she say skulls?
Aunt Jin said. The door slammed. Aha! Wax said, lowering his hand. There it is. Marcy approached and wrapped her arm around the elderly lady's shoulders, leading her away.
Don't worry. It won't be nearly as bad as they make it seem. Likely nothing will happen to you or your hotel.
Other than Wax ripping your windows apart, Wayne noted.
Other than that,
Marcy said, giving him a glare.
Young lady,
Aunt Jin said under her breath,
you need to get away from these people.
They're fine, Maracy said, reaching the door. We've just had a long night. Aunt Jin nodded hesitantly.
Good, Maracy said. Now, when you get down below, would you please send someone to the Trade Bureau for me? Have them collect the names of each and every person who works at the local graveyards.
Graveyards?
It's vitally important, Maracy said, then pushed the woman out and shut the door.
Graveyards?
Milan said, sticking her head into the room. She was now completely bald.
Reminds me, would you order me something to eat? A nice hunk of aged meat?
Rotting, you mean, Wax said.
Nothing like the odor of a nice flank after a day in the sun,
Milan said, ducking back into her room as a knock came at the other door.
Ah, my bags. Excellent. What? No, of course there aren't corpses in these. Why would I need bones with the flesh still on them? Thank you. Bye.
Wayne popped the last of the peanuts into his mouth.
I don't know about you all, but I'm going to find a place to snore for a few hours.
Sleeping arrangements, Waxillium?
Maracy asked.
You and Steris in the suite across the hall, Wax said. Wayne and I in here. Milan gets her own room. She probably wants to,
melt,
Maracy offered.
On her own.
I'm good, really,
Milan called from the next room. A second later, she opened the door again. She wore the same bones and build, but this time she was completely bare-chested. It wasn't a woman's chest.
I solved the problem,
Milan said.
I'll go as a fellow. That will probably be more covert anyway. Just have to choose the right bones.
Wayne cocked his head. She'd sculpted her face, too, giving herself masculine features. Steris's eyes were bulging. At least that was worth seeing.
You're...
Steris said.
You'll become a...
A man?
Milan asked.
Yeah. It'll look better when I've decided on the right body. Need to settle on a voice, too.
She looked around the room.
Is this a problem?
Everyone looked at Wayne for some reason. He thought for a moment, then shrugged. Maybe he should have given his shoes to her.
You don't mind?
Steris demanded of him.
It's still her.
But she looks like a man.
So does the lady what runs this house, Wayne said. Well, she has kids, so someone still decided to take her, and...
It will do, Milan, Wax said, resting a hand on Steris's arm. Assuming you can get into the party.
Don't worry about that,
she said, spinning around.
I will get in and be ready to give you support. But this is your play, Ladrian, not mine. You're the detective. I'm just around for the punchy-punchy, stabby-stabby.
She closed the door. Wayne shook his head.
Now that's a situation a man don't rightly encounter all that often.
Well, he'd found occasion to be an old lady now and then, so it made sense to him. It was probably good for a woman to be a fellow once in a while, if only to offer some perspective. Easier to piss, too. Couldn't discount that. She assumes, Wax said, that our detective style isn't normally the punchy-punchy, stabby-stabby type.
To be fair, Wayne said, it's usually a more shooty-shooty, wacky-wacky type.
Maracy rubbed her forehead.
Why are we having this conversation?
Because we're tired, Wax said. Get some sleep, everyone. Wayne, you're going to go with Maracy tonight and dig up some graves.
He took a deep breath.
And I, unfortunately, am going to a party.
11. Wearing a formal cravat and jacket reminded Wax of the year after he'd left the village. A year when his uncle had gleefully wrapped him in the packaging of a young nobleman and presented him to the city's elite, feeling he'd won some kind of war when Wax was expelled from Terrace society. Wax had moved in with his parents, of course, but it had been his uncle who had overseen his education, grooming him specifically as heir to the house. After that time in the village, Wax's life had grown to be less and less about his immediate family. He'd barely seen his parents during that year, despite living with them. That was when his uncle's grip had really started to strangle him. Wax tapped his fingers on the armrest of his carriage, remembering those parties. How much were his memories of them colored by his uncle's presence? The carriage eventually pulled up before a resplendent mansion with stained glass windows and limelights burning outside. A classical style of lighting, though the interior had little in common with the ancient keeps of lore it was meant to evoke, as he well knew from the floor plans he'd memorized earlier today, while the others were sleeping. This mansion was more sprawling than imposing, with a multi-peaked roof design like the profile of a mountain range. A line of carriages waited to pull through the coach portico and drop off their occupants.
"You're nervous," Steris
said, laying her hand on his arm. She wore white lace gloves, and her dress, which she'd fretted over for at least an hour, was one of the filmy and gauzy ones that the most fashionable ladies in Ellendale were wearing this year. The skirt was more full and cloud-like than the more traditional gowns Steris usually favored. He'd been surprised when she'd chosen it. Most of her wardrobe, especially on this trip, was chosen for utility. Why wear this now?
"I'm not nervous," Wax said. "I'm contemplative."
"Shall we go over the plan?"
"What plan?" Wax said.
Relure, in his ravings, had directed them toward this party of Kalasina Shores, who was a lady of some prestige in New Saren, and who he implied was connected to all this. She was their best lead, though Relure's notebook had also listed 5 other families he thought were of interest. The problem was, none of these notes mentioned why they were of interest, or what it was Relure thought they knew. Why would a group of lords and ladies of the outer city's elite have anything to do with an ancient archaeological relic? True, some noblemen like to consider themselves gentlemen adventurers, but those types mostly sat around smoking cigars and talking. At least that fop Jack actually left his rusting house. Time wore on, as carriages moved up the drive with all the speed of a line of cows on a hot day. Finally, Wax kicked open his door. "Let's walk."
"Oh, dear," Steris said with a sigh. "Again?"
"Don't tell me you didn't plan for this."
"I did. But this line isn't that long, Lord Waxillium. Don't you think this time we should wait?"
"I can see the rusting front doors," Wax said, pointing. "We can walk to them in 30 seconds. Or we can sit here and wait as pompous people waddle out of their seats and fuss with their scarves."
"I see the knight is starting off on the right foot," Steris said.
Wax hopped down, ignoring the footman's offered hand. He waved the man back and helped Steris from the vehicle himself.
"Go ahead and park," he called to the coachman. "We'll call for you when we're done."
He hesitated.
"If you hear gunshots, go back to the hotel. We'll make our own way."
The coachman started, but nodded. Wax held his arm out for Steris, and the two strolled along the path into the mansion grounds, passing carriages full of people who seemed to be trying to glare at them without actually looking in their direction.
"I've prepared a list for you," Steris said.
"I'm so surprised."
"Now, no complaining, Waxillium. It will help. I've put the list in this little book," Steris said, producing a palm-sized notebook, "for ease of reference. Each page contains a conversation opener indexed to the people it will likely work best upon. The numbers below list ways you can segue the conversation into useful areas and perhaps figure out what our targets are up to and what is their connection to the bands of mourning."
"I'm not socially incompetent, Steris," Wax said. "I can make small talk."
"I know that," Steris said, "but I'd rather avoid an incident like the set party."
"Which set party?"
"The one where you headbutted someone."
He cocked his head.
"Oh, right. That smarmy little man with the ridiculous mustache."
"Lord Westweather Set," Steris said. "Heir to the House Fortune."
"Right, right," Wax said. "Stupid Sets. In my defense, he did call me out, demanding to duel a coin shot. I probably saved his life."
"By breaking his nose." Steris held up her hand. "I am not requesting justifications or explanations, Lord Waxillium. I merely thought I'd do what I could to help."
He grumbled, but took the book, flipping through it by lamplight as they walked across the grounds. At the back of the book were descriptions of the various people likely to be at the party. He'd memorized some descriptions Vendel had sent, but this list was far more extensive. As usual, Steris had done her research. He smiled, tucking the book into his jacket pocket. Where had she found the time? They continued up the path, though Wax froze as he heard rustling in the shrubbery nearby. He burned steel instantly, noticing some moving points of metal, and his hand went to the pistol under his jacket. A dirty face peered out and grinned. The eyes were milky white.
"Clips for the poor, good sir,"
the beggar said, stretching out a hand and exposing long, unkempt fingernails and a ragged shirt. Wax kept his hand on his weapon, studying the man. Steris cocked her head.
"Are you wearing cologne, beggar?"
Wax nodded as he too smelled it, faintly. The beggar started, as if surprised, then grinned.
"It's got a good kick to it, m'lady."
"You've been drinking cologne?"
Steris asked.
"Well, that can't be healthy."
"You should be away from here, beggar," Wax said,
eyeing the cluster of attendants and coachmen closer to the building's entrance. "These are private grounds."
"Oh, my lord, I know it. I do."
The beggar laughed.
"I own the place, technically. Now, regarding those coins for old Hoyd, my good lord."
He pushed his hand forward farther, eyes staring sightlessly. Wax dug in his pocket.
"Here." He tossed the man a banknote. "Get off the grounds and find yourself a proper drink."
"A generous lord, indeed,"
the beggar said, dropping to his knees and fishing for the banknote.
"But too much. Far too much."
Wax took Steris's arm again, walking her toward the imposing front doors.
"My lord,"
the beggar screeched.
"Your change."
He saw the blue line moving and reacted immediately, spinning and catching the coin, which had been hurled with exacting accuracy at his head. So, not blind after all. Wax snorted, pocketing the coin, as a passing groundsman saw the beggar and shouted,
"Not you again!"
The beggar cackled and disappeared back into the shrubs.
"What was that about?" Steris asked.
"Damned if I know," Wax said. "Shall we?"
They proceeded down the row of waiting carriages, and though the line had sped up during their stroll, they still reached the front doors before they otherwise would have. Wax tipped his head toward a large woman who barely fit through the door of her carriage, then strode up the steps with Steris on his arm. He presented his card at the door, though they would know to watch for him. This was no simple reception. This was about politics. There would probably be only one official speech, that of the host to the attendees, but everyone knew why they were here. To mingle, share ideas, and likely be invited to donate to one of many causes reflecting Outer City's interests. Wax passed the doorkeeper, who cleared his throat and pointed toward an alcove in the side of the entryway. There, servants were taking hats, coats, and shawls.
"We've nothing to check," Wax said. "Thank you."
The man took Wax's arm gently as he tried to proceed.
"The lady of the house has asked that all attendees be unburdened of items of a vulgar nature, my lord, for the safety of all parties attending."
Wax blinked, then finally got it.
"We have to check weapons? You're kidding."
The tall man said nothing.
"I don't think he's the joking type," Steris noted.
"You realize," Wax said, "that I'm a coin shot. I could kill a dozen people with your cufflinks."
"We'd appreciate it if you didn't," the doorkeeper said. "If you please, Lord Ladrian, there are to be no exceptions. Do we need to call the House Lurcher to make certain you are being honest with us?"
"No," Wax said, pulling his arm free. "But if something goes wrong tonight, you're going to wish we'd never had this conversation."
He walked with Steris to the counter where white-gloved servants were taking hats in exchange for tickets. He reluctantly took Vindication from the holster under his arm and set her on the counter.
"Is that all, my lord?"
the woman there asked. He hesitated, then sighed and knelt, pulling his backup gun, a tiny two-shotter from the holster on his calf. He dropped it onto the counter.
"Might we have a look in the lady's purse?"
the servant asked. Steris submitted.
"You realize," Wax said, "that I'm a deputized constable. If anyone should be armed, it's me."
The servants said nothing, though they seemed embarrassed as they handed back Steris's purse and gave Wax a ticket for his weapons.
"Let's go," he said, pocketing the pasteboard and trying, unsuccessfully, to hide his annoyance.
Together, they approached the ballroom.
Wayne liked how banks worked. They had style. Many people, they'd keep their money out of sight, hidden under beds and some such. What was the fun of that? But a bank was a target. Building a place like this, then stuffing it full of cash, was like climbing atop a hill and daring anyone who approached to try to knock you off. He figured that must be the point, the sport of it. Why else would they put so much valuable stuff together in one place? It was supposed to be a message, proof to the little people that some folks were so rich they could use their money to build a house for their money and still have enough money left to fill that house. Robbing such a place was suicide, so all that potential thieves could do was stand outside and salivate, thinking of the stuff inside. Really, a bank was like a giant sign erected to say "rust off" to everyone who passed by. Which was magnificent. He and Marcy stopped on the long flight of steps up to the front, which was set with stained glass windows and banners, after the classical Cantonesque style of architecture. Marcy wanted to come here before the graveyards, something about the bank records leading them to the right location. "All right, see," Wayne said. "I've got it figured out. I'm going to be a rich fellow. Made loads off of the sweat and blood of lesser men. Only I won't say it like that, 'cause I'll be in character, you see."
"Is that so?"
Marcy said, starting up the steps.
"Yep," Wayne said, joining her. "Even brought my fancy hat."
He held up a top hat and spun it on his finger.
"That hat belongs to Waxillium."
"No, it don't," Wayne said, putting it on. "I give him a rat for it."
"A rat?"
"Minus the tail," Wayne said, "on account of this hat being kind of dusty when I took it. Anyway, I'll be the rich fellow. You be my younger brother's daughter."
"I'm not young enough to be your niece," Marcy said. "At least not one who—"
She trailed off as Wayne scrunched his face up good, emphasizing wrinkles, and brought out his fake mustache.
"Right," she added. "I'd forgotten about that."
"No, my dear," Wayne said. "While I am distracting the employees of this fine establishment with a depository request, you shall steal into their records room and acquaint yourself with the requisite information. It shouldn't test your skills, as I shall regale them with descriptions of my wealth and prestige, which should draw the attention of most who are still working at this late hour."
"Wonderful," Marcy said.
"As an aside, my dear," Wayne added, "I am not fond at all of your dalliance with that farmhand upon our estate. He is far beneath you in stature, and your indiscretion will surely besmirch our good name."
"Oh, please."
"Plus, he has warts," Wayne added as they reached the top of the steps, "and is prone to extreme bouts of flatulence, and—"
"Are you going to be talking about this the entire time?"
"Of course. The bank's employees need to know how I toil with the next generation and its woefully inadequate ability to make decisions my generation found simple and obvious."
"Grand,"
Marcy said, pushing through the bank's broad glass doors. A banker immediately rushed up to them.
"I'm sorry, we're very near closing."
"My good man,"
Wayne began,
"I'm certain you can make time for the investment opportunity you will soon find present in—"
"We're from the Ellendale Constabulary,"
Marcy interrupted, taking out her engraved credential plate and holding it up.
"Captain Marcy Combs, I'd like to look over some of your deposit records. Shouldn't take but a few minutes and I'll be out of your hair."
Wayne floundered, then gaped at her as the banker, a squat, swarthy man who had a gut like a cannonball and a head to match, took her certification and looked it over. That was cheating.
What records do you need? The banker asked guardedly. Do any of these people have accounts with you?
Marcy asked, proffering a paper.
I suppose I can check, the banker said.
He sighed and walked farther into the building to where a clerk sat going over ledgers. He slid through a door behind the desk, and Wayne could hear him muttering to himself in the room beyond.
Now I've got to say, Wayne said, pulling off the top hat, that was the worst example of acting I've ever seen. Who would believe that the rich uncle has a constable for a niece, anyway?
There's no need to lie when the truth will work just as well, Wayne.
No need? Of course there's need! Why, what happens when we have to thump some people, then run off with their ledgers? They're gonna know it was us, and Wax'll have to pay a big heap of compensatory fines.
Fortunately, we're not going to be thumping anyone.
But...
No thumping.
Wayne sighed. Fat lot of fun this was going to be.
I'll have you know that we take the privacy of our patrons very seriously, the banker explained, hand protectively on the ledgers he'd retrieved from the records room. They sat in his office now, and he had a little desk plaque that named him Mr. Areola. Neither of the others seemed to grasp why Wayne snickered when he read that.
I understand, Marcy said, but I have a healthy suspicion one of these men is a criminal. Certainly you don't want to abet their activities.
I don't want to violate their trust in me either, the banker said. What makes you so certain these men are criminals? Do you have any proof?
The proof, Marcy said, will be in the numbers. She leaned forward. Do you know how many crimes can be proven by looking at statistics?
Considering the question, I'm going to assume it's a non-trivial number, the banker said, leaning back in his chair and lacing his hands on his ample belly.
Yes, Marcy said. Most crimes can be traced to either passion or wealth. Where wealth is involved, numbers come into play, and where numbers come into play, forensic accounting gives us answers.
The banker didn't seem convinced, but then in Wayne's estimation he didn't seem completely human, either. He was at least part dolphin. The man continued plying Marcy with questions, obviously stalling for some reason. That made Wayne uncomfortable. Usually, when people stalled like that, it was so their mates could have time to arrive and administer a proper beating. He bided his time, playing with objects on the banker's desk, trying to build a tower of them, but he kept his eyes on the door. If someone did arrive to attack them, he'd have to toss Marcy out the window to get away. A moment later, the door swung open. Wayne grabbed for Marcy, his other hand going for one of his dueling canes, but it was only the clerk from outside. She bustled over to the banker, so Wayne didn't feel a bit guilty admiring her bustle, so to speak, and handed him a half sheet of paper.
"What's that?"
Marcy asked as the woman left.
"Telegram," Wayne guessed, relaxing. "Checking up on us, are you?"
The banker hesitated, then turned the paper around. It contained a description of Wayne and Marcy, followed by the words, "They are indeed constables under my command. Please afford them every courtesy and liberty in your establishment, though do keep an eye on the short man, and check your till after he leaves."
"Here now," Wayne said. "That's right unfair. Those things cost a clip every 5 words to send, they do. Already wasted good money libeling me."
"Technically, it's defamation," Marcy said.
"Yep," Wayne said. "Manure through and through."
"Defamation, Wayne, not..."
"Oh, never mind." She met the eyes of the banker.
"Are you satisfied?"
"I suppose," he said, then slid the ledgers over to her.
"Numbers," Marcy said, digging in her purse for a moment. She brought out a small book and tapped it with one finger. "This contains a list of the common wages for workers in the cemetery business, by the job they do." She pulled open the ledgers. "Now, looking at the deposits by our men in question, we can find patterns. Who is putting more money in the bank than their payroll would reasonably account for?"
"Surely this isn't enough to convict a man," the banker said.
"We're not looking to convict," Marcy said, looking through the first ledger. "I just need a little direction."
In the minutes that followed, Wayne got his tower to balance with 6 separate items, including the stapler, which left him feeling rather proud. Eventually, Maracy tapped on one of the ledgers.
"Well?"
the banker asked.
"Did you find your culprit?"
"Yes," Maracy said, sounding disturbed. "All of them."
"All of them?"
"Every rotten one," Maracy said. No pun intended. She took a deep breath, then slapped a ledger closed. "I guess I could have picked one at random, Mr. Areola. But still, it is good to know."
"To know what?"
"That they're all crooked," she said, and started fishing in her purse again. "I should have guessed. Most corpses are buried with something valuable, if only the clothing. No use letting that all rot away." The banker paled.
"They're selling the clothing off the dead people?"
"That," Maracy said, slipping a small bottle of Sile's brandy out of her purse and setting it on the table. "And perhaps any jewelry or other personal effects buried with the bodies?"
"Hey," Wayne said. "I'm right dry in the throat, I am. That would sure hit me well, like a morning piss after a 9-pint of the night afore."
"That's horrible," the banker said. "Yes," Maracy said, "but if you think about it, not too horrifying. The only crimes being perpetrated here are against the dead, and their legal rights are questionable." Wayne fished in his pocket a moment, then brought out a silver letter opener. Where did he get that? He set it on the table and took the drink, downing it in one shot. "Thank you for your time, Mr. Areola," Maracy continued, taking the letter opener and sliding it toward the banker. "You've been very helpful." The banker looked at the letter opener with a start, then checked his desk drawer.
"Hey, that's mine,"
he said, reaching into the desk and pulling out something that looked like a piece of cord.
"Is this a rat's tail?"
"Longest I've ever seen," Wayne said. "Quite a prize. Lucky man you are."
"How in the world did you—"
The banker looked from Wayne to Maracy, then rubbed his head.
"Are we finished here?"
"Yes," Maracy said, standing. "Let's go, Wayne."
"Off to make an arrest,"
the banker said, dropping the tail into the wastebasket, which was a crime in and of itself. The thing was almost 2 hands long. "Arrest?" Maracy asked. "Nonsense, Mr. Areola. We aren't here to arrest anyone."
"Then what was the point of all that?"
"Why," Maracy said, "I had to know whom to employ, of course. Come along, Wayne." 12. So little had changed since Wax's youth. Oh, the people at this party wore slightly different clothing. Formal waistcoats had grown stouter and hemlines had risen to mid-calf, while necklines had plunged, with mere bits of gauze draping across the neck and down the shoulders. The people, though, were the same. They weighed him, calculating his worth, hiding daggers behind ready smiles. He met their condescending nods and didn't miss his guns as much as he would have thought. Those were not the right weapons for this fight.
"I used to be so nervous at these things," Wax said softly to Steris. "When I was a kid, that was when I still cared about their opinions, I guess, before I learned how much power over a situation you gain when you decide that you don't care what others think of you."
Steris eyed a couple of passing ladies in their completely laceless gowns.
"I'm not certain I agree. How you are perceived is important. For example, I'm regretting my choice of gown. I was shooting for fashionable, but fashion is different down here. I'm not in style. I'm avant-garde."
"I like it," Wax said. "It stands out."
"So does a pimple," Steris said. "Why don't you get us some drinks, and I'll take stock of the room and figure out where our targets are."
Wax nodded in agreement. The grand ballroom was carpeted and adorned with golden chandeliers, though their candle holders glowed with electric lights. The ceiling wasn't terribly high, but the walls were colorfully decorated with false archways that each held a mural. Classical pieces, like the ascendant warrior rising above a flock of ravens, the typical depiction of the Lord Ruler's wraiths, of whom only Death himself remained. Though nobody approached him, they also didn't avoid him. If anything, they remained determinedly in his path, refusing to budge, then acted like they hadn't noticed him as he wove around them. He was from Ellendale, their political enemy, and in not moving they made a statement. Rusts, he hated these games. The bar covered almost the entire length of the far wall and was serviced by at least 24 bartenders, so as to make absolutely certain none of the very important guests had to wait. He ordered wine for Steris and a simple gin and tonic for himself, which got him a raised eyebrow. Apparently that wasn't fancy enough. Should have ordered straight-up whiskey. He turned and scanned the room as the bartender prepared the drinks. Soft music by a harpist helped cover the many conversations. It made him uncomfortable to admit that some of the casual discussions in a room like this could do more to affect the lives of the Basin's people than putting any criminal, no matter how vile, in prison. Maracy is always talking about things like that, he thought. How the law-keeping of the future will be about statistics, not shotguns. He tried to imagine a world where murders were prevented by careful civic planning, and found himself unable to see it. People would always kill. Still, sometimes it was hard not to feel like the one chandelier in the room that still required candles. "Your order, my lord," the bartender said, setting the drinks down on fancy cloth napkins, each embroidered with the date of the party. Those would be for the attendees to take as keepsakes. Wax fished a coin from his pocket for a tip and slid it to the bartender. He grabbed his drinks to head back to Steris, but the bartender cleared his throat. The man held up the coin, and it was not a 5-spin as Wax had meant to give him. In fact, it was unlike any coin Wax had ever seen. "Was this a mistake, my lord?" the man asked. "I don't mean to be ungrateful, but I'd hate to take something that looks like a memento." The symbols on that coin, Wax thought, stepping back to the bar. They're the same as the ones on the walls in the pictures Relure took. He nearly overturned the wine glass of another guest in his haste to grab the coin back. He absently shoved the bartender another tip and held up the coin. Those were the same symbols, or very similar, and it had a face on the back, that of a man looking straight outward, one eye pierced by a spike. The large coin was made of two different metals, an outside ring and an inner one. The coin certainly didn't seem old. Was it new, or merely well-preserved? Rust and ruin, how had this gotten into his pocket? The beggar tossed it to me, Wax thought. But where had he gotten it? Were there more of these in circulation? Troubled, he struck out to find Steris. As he walked, he passed Lady Calisina, the party's hostess, and the woman who was his eventual target. The older woman stood resplendent in a gown of black and silver, holding miniature court before a group of people asking after one of her civic projects. Wax listened in for a moment, but didn't want to confront the woman yet. He eventually located Steris, standing beside a tall, thin table near the corner. There weren't any chairs in the ballroom, nor dancing either, though there was a dance floor raised an inch or two in the center of the chamber. Wax set the coin on the table and slid it to Steris.
"What's this?" she asked.
"The coin that the beggar threw at me. Those symbols look similar to the ones in the pictures Relure took." Steris pursed her lips, then turned the coin over and looked at the other side.
"A face with one eye spiked through. Does it mean something?"
"No idea," Wax said. "I'm more interested in how that beggar got it, and why he threw it at me. It has to be a relic Relure found at that temple. Could he have lost it, or traded it to someone in the city?" He tapped the table with one finger, certain now that beggar had been something more than he pretended. He was equally certain that if he went hunting now, he'd find that the man had vanished. Eventually, Wax pocketed the coin. "We have to hope that the answers are in this room somewhere, assuming Calisina really is involved."
"Then it's time to get to work."
"I passed her back there. Shall we?"
"Not yet. See that couple over there? The man has on a maroon waistcoat."
Wax followed her nod. The couple she indicated were young, well-dressed, and smug. Great.
"That is Lord Garvey Entrone," Steris said. Your houses have had some minor business dealings. He's in textiles, which should give you an opening to speak with him.
I've heard of him, Wax said. I courted a cousin of his once. It went poorly.
Well, he's also on the list your mad Condra made in his notebook, so he might know something. He's young, dynamic, and well-regarded, but not terribly important, so he'll work nicely as a first try.
Right, Wax said, eyeing Entrone, who had drawn a crowd of several more young women as he told a story that involved lots of gesturing. He took a deep breath. You want to take the lead?
It should be you.
You sure? I can't help feeling I'd be better put to use with Maracy and Wayne digging in graves, while you are comfortable here. You're good at these things, Steris, you really are. And don't give me any more of your rhetoric about being boring. Her expression grew distant.
In this case, it's not that I'm boring, it's more that I'm off. I've learned to fake being normal, but lists of prepared comments and jokes can only take me so far. People can sense that I'm not being authentic, that I don't like the things they like or think the way they do. Sometimes it amazes me that people like Wayne, or even those Condra, can be so startlingly human when I feel so alien.
He wished he could figure out how to keep her from saying things like that. He didn't know the right words. Every time he tried to argue the point, it only seemed to make her withdraw. Steris held out an arm to him. He took it, and together they crossed the room toward Lord Gabe and the small crowd he had drawn. Wax had worried about how to break into the conversation, but as soon as he neared, the people talking to Gabe stepped back and made room for him. His reputation and status had preceded him, apparently.
"My Lord Waxillium," Gabe said with a knowing smile. "I was delighted when I heard that you were going to attend our little gathering. I've wanted to meet you for years."
Wax nodded to him, then to his date and a couple he'd been chatting with. Those two didn't retreat.
"How are you finding New Saren, my lord?"
one of the ladies asked him.
"Seems mighty inconvenient to get around," Wax said. "Nice otherwise, though."
They laughed at that, as if he'd said something humorous. He frowned. What had he missed?
"I'm afraid," Gabe said, "you won't find much to interest you here. New Saren is a quiet city."
"Oh, but what were you saying, Lord Gabe?"
the other young man said.
"Don't misrepresent our town. The nightlife here is fantastic, Lord Waxillium, and the symphony has been given a citation of excellence by two of your previous governors." "Yes," Gabe said. "But there aren't many shootouts."
The others gave him blank stares.
"I was a lawman," Wax told them, "in the roughs."
One of the ladies said. "You oversaw a city's constable precinct?"
"No, he was a real lawman," Gabe said. "The ride a horse and shoot bandits type. You should read the accounts. They're all the rage in the Ellendale broadsheets."
The three others regarded him with bemused expressions.
"How unique,"
one of the ladies finally said.
"The accounts are exaggerated," Steris said quickly. "Lord Waxillium has only been directly responsible for the deaths of around 100 people, unless you include those who died of infection after he shot them. I'm still not sure how to count those."
"It was a difficult life," Wax said, looking toward Gabe, who smiled behind his cup of wine, eyes twinkling.
For a man like him, Wax and Steris were obviously good sport.
"But that is behind me now. Lord Gabe, I wanted to thank you for our years of mutually profitable trade."
"Oh, don't bring business into it, Lord Waxillium," Gabe said with a tip of his wine. "This is a party."
The others laughed. Again, Wax had no idea why. "Damn," he thought, looking between them, "I am rusty." He'd complained, dragged his feet, but he hadn't expected to be this clumsy. Focus. Gabe knew something about the bands of mourning, or at least Relor had thought he did.
"Do you have any hobbies, Lord Gabe?" Wax asked, earning an eager nod from Steris at the comment.
"Nothing of real note," Gabe said.
"He loves archaeology,"
his date said at the same time, though. He gave her a dry look.
"Archaeology," Wax said. "That's hardly unnotable, Lord Gabe."
He loves relics, the lady said. Spends hours at the auction house snatching up anything he...
I like history, Gabe interjected. Artworks from times past inspires me. But you, dear, are making me sound too much like one of those gentleman adventurers.
He sneered at the term.
I'm sure you saw the type up in the roughs, Lord Waxillium. Men who'd spend their lives in society but suddenly decided to go off seeking some kind of thrill or another where they didn't belong.
Steris stiffened. Wax met the man's gaze levelly. The insult, veiled though it was similar to those he'd suffered in Ellendale society.
Better they try something new, Wax said, as opposed to wasting their lives in the same old activities.
My Lord Waxillium, Gabe said, disappointing one's family is hardly original. People have been doing it since the days of the last emperor.
Wax made a fist at his side. He was accustomed to insults, but this one still got under his skin. Perhaps it was because he was on edge, or perhaps it was because of his worry about his sister. He pushed down his anger, Steris squeezing his arm, and tried another tactic.
Is your cousin well? Valette? Most certainly. We are all pleased with her new marriage. I'm sorry your relationship didn't work out, but the man who courted her after you was dreadful. When titles are part of a union, it's always unpleasant to see what crawls out from the mists looking for a bone.
He didn't look at Steris as he said it. He didn't need to. That sly smile, so self-satisfied as he sipped his wine.
You rat, Wax growled. You rusting, spineless rat.
He reached for his gun, which, fortunately, wasn't there. The other three young nobles looked to him, shocked. Gave grinned in a cocky way before adopting an expression of outrage.
Excuse me, he said, turning his date by the arm and striding away.
The others scuttled after. Wax sighed, lowering his arm, still angry.
He did that deliberately, he muttered. Didn't he? He wanted an excuse to leave the conversation, so he insulted me. When that didn't work, he flung one at you, knowing I'd overreact.
Steris said. Yes, you have the right of it.
Steris nodded. Other people nearby made conversation, but they left an open space around Wax and Steris.
I'm sorry, Wax said. I let him get to me.
That's why we tried him first, Steris said. Good practice. And we did learn something. The archaeology comment prodded too close to something he didn't want to discuss. He turned to veiled insults to distract us.
Wax took a deep breath, shoving away his annoyance at this entire situation.
What now? Do we try another one?
No, Steris said, thoughtful. We don't want our targets to know that we're approaching them specifically. If you interact with unaffiliated people in between, our pattern will be more difficult to spot.
Right, Wax said, looking through the busy hall as the harpist retreated and a full band, with brass, something you'd never see at a party in Ellendale, began setting up instruments in her place.
He and Steris sipped drinks as the music started. Though it was slow enough to encourage dancing with a partner, there was a pep to it Wax hadn't expected. He found he quite liked it. It seemed to be able to beat out his frustration, turn it to something more excited instead.
"Why don't you go there next?" Steris said, nodding toward a distinguished older woman with her gray hair in a bun. "That's Lady Felise de Meux, accompanied by her nephew. You've had business dealings with her. She's exactly the sort of person you'd be expected to seek out. I'll refill our drinks."
"Get me a seltzer," Wax said. "I'll need my mind clear for this."
Steris nodded, moving off through the crowd as people made way for dancing in the center of the room. Wax approached Lady de Meux and introduced himself with a card given to her nephew, then requested a dance, which was accepted. Small talk. He could do small talk.
What is wrong with you, Wax?
He thought at himself as he accompanied Lady de Meux to the dance floor. You can interrogate a criminal without trouble. Why do you dread simple conversation? Part of him wanted to dismiss it as mere laziness,
but that was his response to everything he didn't want to do. An excuse. What was it really? Why was he so reluctant? It's because these are their rules. If I play by them, I accept their games. It felt like he was accepting their collar. He turned to raise his hand to the side for Lady Demu to take. However, as he did, a different woman slid into place and grasped his hand, towing him into the dancing and away from the perimeter. He was so surprised that he let it happen. "Excuse me," Wax said.
"No excuses necessary," the woman said. "I won't take but a moment of your time."
She looked to be Terrace, judging by her dark skin, though hers was darker than most he'd seen. Her hair was in tight braids, streaked with gray, and her face bore full, luscious lips. She took the lead in the dance, causing him to stumble.
"You realize," she said, "that you are a very rare specimen. Crasher. A coin shot and a skimmer."
"Neither are that rare," Wax said, "in terms of metal-born."
"Ah, but any twin-born combination is rare indeed. Mistings are 1 in 1,000, most fairings even more unusual, and their bloodlines constrained. To arrive at any specific combination of two is highly improbable. You are one of only 3 crashers ever born, Lord Waxillium."
"What, really?"
"I cannot, of course, be 100% certain of that figure. Infant mortality on Scadrial is not as bad as some regions, but still shockingly high. Tell me, have you ever tried increasing your weight while in midair?"
"Who are you?" Wax said, stepping into the dance and seizing back control, twisting her to his right.
"Nobody important," she said.
"Did my uncle send you?"
"I have little interest in your local politics, Lord Waxillium," she replied. "If you would kindly answer my questions, I will let you be."
He turned with her to the music. They danced more quickly than he was accustomed to, though the steps were familiar. The constant intrusion of those brass instruments drove the song, made his steps seem to spring. Why had he mentioned his uncle? Sloppy.
"I have increased my weight while moving," he said slowly. "It doesn't do anything. All things fall at the same speed, regardless of how heavy they are."
"Yes, the uniformity of gravitation," the woman said. "That's not what I'm curious about. What if you're soaring through the air on a steel push and you suddenly make yourself heavier? What happens?"
"I slow down. I'm so much heavier that it's harder to push myself forward."
"Ah," the woman said softly. "So it is true."
"What?"
"Conservation of momentum," she said. "Lord Waxillium, when you store weight, are you storing mass, or are you changing the planet's ability to recognize you as something to attract? Is there a difference? Your answer gives me a clue. If you slow when you become heavier mid-flight, then that is not likely due to you having trouble pushing, but due to the laws of physics."
She stepped back from him in the middle of the dance, releasing his hands and sidestepping another couple, who gave them a glare for interfering with the flow of the dance. She produced a card and handed it toward him.
"Please experiment with this further and send me word. Thank you. Now, if I can just figure out why there's no redshift involved in speed bubbles."
With that, she wandered off the floor, leaving him befuddled in the middle of the dancing. Suddenly conscious of how many stares he was drawing, he lifted his chin and sauntered off the dance floor, where he found Lady Demu and apologized to her profusely for the interruption. She allowed him to have the next dance, which passed without incident, save for Wax having to hear a protracted description of Lady Demu's prize-winning hounds. Once done, he tried to find the strange woman with the braids, even going so far as to approach the doorkeeper and ask for her. The card had an address in Ellendale, but no name. The doorman claimed he hadn't admitted anyone by that description, which left Wax even more troubled. His uncle was trying to breed allomancers. A woman asking after the specifics of allomantic powers couldn't be a coincidence, could it? He did pass Milan. Square-chinned, standing over 6 feet tall, her masculine body bulged with muscles beneath her tuxedo, and she'd drawn a gaggle of interested young ladies. She winked at Wax as he passed, but he gave her no response. Steris had a drink waiting for him at the table, where she was flipping through pages of her notebook and mumbling. As Wax neared, he noticed a young man approach and try to engage her in conversation, but she dismissed him with a wiggle of her fingers, not even looking up. The man, deflated, drifted away. Wax stepped up to the table. "Not interested in dancing?"
"What would be the point?"
she said. "Well, I'm going out and dancing, so maybe you could, too."
"You are lord of your house," Steris said absently, still reading. "You have political and economic obligations. Anyone who would want to do the same with me is simply trying to get to you, something for which I have no time."
"Either that," Wax said, "or he thought you were pretty." Steris looked up from her notes and cocked her head as if the thought hadn't even occurred to her.
"I'm engaged."
"Weren't you here?" Wax said. "Largely unknown save to those who pay attention to Ellendale politics. The lad probably didn't know who you were." Steris blinked very pointedly. She actually seemed troubled by the idea that someone unknown might find her attractive. Wax smiled, reaching for the cup she'd set out for him. "What is this?"
"Soda water," she said.
He held it up to the light. "It's yellow."
"All the rage here, apparently,"
Steris said,
"with lemon flavoring."
Wax took a drink, then nearly choked.
"What?"
Steris asked, alarmed.
"Poison?"
"Sugar," Wax said. "About 7 cups of it."
Steris took a sip, then pulled back.
"How odd. It's like champagne, only not."
Wax shook his head. "What was wrong with people in this city?"
"I've decided upon our next target," Steris said, pointing toward a man across the room, leaning against the archway near some tanks of exotic fish.
In his 30s, he wore his jacket unbuttoned with a kind of purposeful sloppiness. Occasionally, someone else would approach and talk to him for a short time, then move back out into the crowd.
"They're reporting to him?" Wax asked.
"Devlin Ayres," Steris said with a nod. "Informant. You'll find his sort at any party. He's either one of the least important people in the room or one of the most important, depending upon the secrets you're interested in discovering. He was also on Relure's list."
Wax studied the man for a time, and when he looked back toward Steris, half of his fizzy yellow drink was gone. She looked innocently in the other direction.
"Probably best," she said, "if you approach him alone. His type doesn't like an audience."
"All right," Wax said, taking a deep breath.
"You can do this, Lord Waxillium."
He nodded.
"I mean it,"
Steris said, resting her hand on his.
"Lord Waxillium, this is exactly what you've been doing for the last 20 years in the roughs."
"I could shoot people there, Steris."
"Could you really? Is that how you solved things? You couldn't get answers, so you shot somebody?"
"Well, I usually just punch them."
She gave him a raised eyebrow. "To be honest, no. I didn't have to shoot or punch all that often. But the rules were different. Hell, I could make the rules if I needed to."
"Same goes here," Steris said. "These people know things that you need to know. You need to either trick them or trade with them, as you've always done."
"Perhaps you're right."
"Thank you. Besides, who knows? Maybe he'll pull a knife on you and you'll get an excuse to punch him anyway."
"Don't get my hopes up," he said, then gave her a nod and walked across the room.
The gates to the Saren New District Cemetery were topped with a crouching statue of the survivor, scarred arms spread wide and gripping the metalwork arch on either side. Marcy felt dwarfed by the statue's looming intensity, brass cloak tassels spreading out in a radial flare behind him, his metallic face glaring down at those who entered. A spear through his back pierced the front of his chest, the polished tip emerging to hang a foot below the center of the arch. When she and Wayne passed beneath it, Marcy felt as if it should drip blood upon her. She shivered, but didn't slow her step. She refused to be intimidated by the survivor's glare. She'd been raised survivorist, so the gruesome imagery associated with the religion was familiar to her. It was just that every time she saw a depiction of the survivor, his posture seemed so demanding. It was like he wanted people to recognize the contradiction in his religion.
He commanded that people survive, yet the death imagery associated with him was a cruel reminder that they'd eventually fail in that task. Survivorism, therefore, was not about winning, but about lasting as long as you could before you lost. The survivor himself, of course, broke the rules. He always had. Doctrine explained he was not dead, but surviving and planning to return in their time of greatest need. But if the end of the world hadn't been enough to get him to return in his glory, then what could possibly do so? They wound through the graveyard, seeking the caretaker's building. Evening had fallen, and the mists had decided to come out tonight. She tried not to take that as any kind of sign, but it did make the place look extra creepy. Gravestones and statues were shadowed in the churning mists. Some nights she saw the mists as playful. Tonight, their unpredictable motions seemed more a crowd of shifting spirits watching her and Wayne, angered at their intrusion. Wayne started whistling. That sent another shiver up Marcy's spine. Fortunately, the gravekeeper's building was now only a short distance up the path. She could see its lights creating a bubble of yellow in the mists. She stuck close to Wayne, not because she felt more comfortable having him beside her.
"Our target is a man named DeChamp," she said. "Should be the night gravekeeper and one of those whose ledger entries show regular upticks in income. He's grave-robbing for sure. In fact, this cemetery showed the highest frequency of that, and the ledgers listed it as the place the city pays to take care of unidentified bodies. I'm reasonably certain the Convra's remains ended up here. We just need to find this man and get him to dig for us."
Wayne nodded.
"This won't be like the banker," Marcy said, who was reluctant but ultimately helpful.
"Really?" Wayne said. "Because I thought he was kind of a tit."
"Focus, Wayne. We'll have to use the full weight of the law here to push this man. I suspect we'll have to offer clemency to get him to help us."
"Wait, wait,"
Wayne said, stopping on the path, tendrils of mist curling around his brow.
"You're going to flash your goods at him, too?"
"I really wish you wouldn't phrase it that way."
"Now listen," Wayne said softly. "You were right about the banker. You did damn good work in there, Marcy, and I'm not too proud to admit it. But authority works different out here in the world of regular men. You bring out your credentials with this fellow, and I guarantee he's going to react like a rabbit. Find the nearest hole, hunker down, not say a word."
"Good interrogation techniques ain't worth beans if you're in a hurry," Wayne said.
"Which we are. I'm putting my foot down."
He hesitated.
"Sides, I already lifted your credentials."
"You—"
Marcy started, then rummaged through her purse and discovered that the small engraved plate that held her constable's credentials was gone, replaced by an empty bottle of Siles brandy.
"Oh, please. This isn't worth nearly the same as those credentials."
"Oh, no, I gave you a good deal," Wayne said, "'cause yours is only a bit of useless metal, which is about what it'd be worth here in this cemetery."
"You will give the credentials back after we're done."
"Sure, if you fill that bottle in trade."
"But you said—"
"Convenience fee,"
Wayne said, then looked up the path toward the gravekeeper's building. He took his top hat off and stomped on it. Marcy stepped back, hand to her breast as Wayne ground the hat beneath his heel, then brought it up and twisted it the other way. Finally, after inspecting it critically, he pulled a knife off his metal belt and cut a hole in the hat's side. He tossed aside his duster and cut off one of the straps of his suspenders. When the top hat went back on his head, he looked shockingly like a vagrant. Of course, he was always one step from that, but it was still surprising how much of a difference two little changes could make. He spun the knife in his hand and inspected Marcy with a critical eye. The sun had set completely, but with the light of the city diffusing through the mists, it could actually be brighter on a night like this than on one without any mist.
"What?"
Marcy said, uncomfortable.
"You look too fancy," Wayne said.
Marcy glanced down at herself. She wore a simple sky-blue day dress, hem at mid-calf, laced up the sleeves and neck.
"This is pretty ordinary, Wayne."
"Not for what we'll be doing."
"I can be your employer or something.
Men like this don't open up none if there's someone respectable about.
He spun the knife in his hand, then reached for her chest.
Wayne,
she said.
Don't be so stiff. You want this done right, right?
She sighed.
Don't get frisky.
Sooner get frisky with a lion, Mara, that I would.
He cut the opaque lace window out of her bodice, leaving her with a plunging neckline. Her sleeves went next, shortened by a good foot to above the elbow. He took the lace there and tied it like a ribbon around her dress right beneath her breasts, then pulled the laces on the back of the dress more tightly. That lifted and thrust her upper chest outward in a decidedly scandalous way. From there, he made a few choice slits on the skirt before rubbing dirt on the bottom parts. He stepped back, tapping his cheek thoughtfully, and nodded. Marcy looked down, inspecting his handiwork, and was actually impressed. Beyond enhancing the bust, he'd cut along seams, pulling out threads, and the effect wasn't so much ruined as used.
"Everyone looks at the chest first," Wayne said. "Even women. Which is kind of strange, but that's the way it is. Like this, nobody will care that the dirt looks too fresh and the rest of the dress ain't aged properly."
"Wayne, I'm shocked," she said. "You're an excellent seamstress."
"Clothes is fun to play with. Ain't no reason that can't be manly."
His eyes lingered on her chest.
"Wayne."
"Sorry, sorry. Just getting into character, you know."
He waved for her to follow, and they headed up the path. As they did, Marcy realized something. She wasn't blushing.
"Well, that's a first," she thought,
growing strangely confident.
"Try not to open your mouth much," Wayne advised as they approached the hut. "On account of you normally sounding way too smart."
"I'll see what I can do."
He snapped a branch off a tree they passed, spun it around his finger, then held it down before himself like a gnarled cane. Together they approached the glowing building, a small thatched structure that had a few weathered mistwraith statues sticking up from its mossy yard. The statues, made in the form of skeletons with skin pulled tight across the skulls, were traditionally thought to ward away the real things, as mistwraiths could be very territorial. Marcy suspected the creatures could tell the difference between real and stone members of their species, but of course scientists claimed that the mistwraiths hadn't even survived the Katasandra in the first place, so the question was probably moot. A greasy little man with a blonde ponytail whistled to himself beside the hut, sharpening his shovel with a whetstone. "Who sharpens a shovel?" Marcy thought, as Wayne presented himself, chest thrust out, improvised cane before him, as if he were some grand attendee at a ball.
"And all you," Wayne said, "being the one called Deschamp?"
"Deschamp,"
the man said, looking up lazily.
"Now, now, did I leave that gate open again? I am supposed to be closing the thing each night. I'll have to be asking you to leave this premises, sir."
"I'll make me own way out, then,"
Wayne said, pointing with his cane stick, yet not moving.
"But afore I go, I would like to make you aware of a special business proposition regarding you and me."
Wayne had exaggerated his accent to the point that Marcy had to pay strict attention to make out what he was saying. Beyond that, there was a more staccato sense to it, more stressed syllables, more of a rhythm to the sentences. It was, she realized, very similar to the accent the gravekeeper was using.
"I'm an honest man, I am,"
Deschamps said, drawing his whetstone along his shovel.
"I don't have no business or needs to discuss, particularly not at a time of night like this one here." "Oh, I've heard of your honesty,"
Wayne said, rolling back on his heels, hands on his cane before him.
"Heard it spoken of from one street to the next. Everyone's talking about your honesty, Deschamp. It's a right keen topic of interest."
"If everyone's saying so much," Deschamp replied, "then you'll know I already got plenty of people with whom to share me honesty. I'm gainfully contracted."
"That don't matter none for our business."
"I do think it might."
"Say it won't,"
Wayne said.
on account of my needing only one special little item that nobody else would find of interest."
The champ looked Wayne up and down. Then he eyed Marcy, and his eyes lingered as Wayne had said they would. Finally, the champ smiled and stood, calling into the hut.
"Boy! Boy!"
A child scrambled out into the mists, bleary-eyed and wearing a dirty smock and trousers.
"Sir?"
"Go and kindly do a round of the yard," the champ said. "Make sure we ain't disturbed."
The boy grew wide-eyed, then nodded and scampered off into the mists. The champ rested his shovel on his shoulder, pocketing the whetstone.
"Now, what can I be calling you, good sir?"
"Mr. Coins will do," Wayne said, "and I'll be calling you Mr. Smartman for the decision you just made right here and now."
He was changing his accent. It was subtle, but Marcy could tell he'd shifted it just faintly.
"Nothing is set as of yet," the champ said. "I just like to give that boy some exercise now and then. Keeps his health." "Of course," Wayne said. "And I understand completely that nothing has been promised. But I tell you, this thing I want, ain't nobody else going to give you a clip for it." "If that's so, then why are you so keen for it?"
"Sentimental value," Wayne said. "It belonged to a friend, and it was really hard for him to part with it."
Marcy snorted in surprise at that one, drawing the champ's attention.
"Are you the friend?"
"I don't speak Ska," she said in the ancient Terrace language. "Could you perhaps talk in Terrace, please?"
Wayne winked at her.
"No use to champ. I can't get her to speak proper no matter how much I try. But she's fine to look at, ain't she?"
He nodded slowly.
"If in this item be under my watchful care, where might it be found?"
"There was a right tragic accident in town a few weeks back," Wayne said. "Explosives. People dead. I hear they brought the pieces to you."
"Bilmy runs the day shift," the champ said. "He brought 'em in. The ones what weren't claimed, the city put in a nice little grave. They was mostly beggars and whores. And right undeserving of death,"
Wayne said, taking off his hat and putting it over his breast.
"Let's go see them."
"You want to go tonight?" "Even it ain't too much a sweat."
"Not much sweat, Mr. Coins," the champ said. "But your name had better match your intentions."
Wayne promptly got out a few banknotes and waved them. The champ snatched them, sniffed them for some reason, then shoved them in his pocket.
"Well, those ain't coins, but they'll do. Come on, then."
He took out an oil lantern, then led them into the mists. "You changed your accent," Marcy whispered to Wayne as they followed a short distance behind.
"Aged it back a tad," Wayne explained softly. "Use the accent of a generation past."
"There's a difference?"
He looked shocked.
"Of course there is, woman. Made me sound older. Like his parents. More authority."
He shook his head as if he couldn't believe she'd even asked. The champ's lantern reflected off the mists as they walked, and that actually made it harder to see in the night, but he'd probably need it when digging. It did little to dispel the eeriness of gravestones broken by the occasional twisted mist-wraith image. She understood, logically, why the tradition would have grown up. If there was one place she wanted to keep scavengers away from, it would be the graveyard. Except that the place had its own set of human scavengers, so the statues weren't working.
"Now," the champ said, and Wayne caught up to listen, "I'll have you know that I am an honest man."
"Of course," Wayne said.
"But I'm also a thrifty man."
"Ain't we all?" Wayne said. "I never buys the fancy beer, even when it's last call and the bartender halves it to the empty barrel."
"You're a man after me own heart, then," the champ said. "Thrifty. What's the good of letting things rot and waste away, I says? The survivor, He didn't waste nothing useful.
Except noblemen, Wayne said. Wasted a fair number of them.
Wasn't a waste, the champ said, chuckling. That there was weapons testing. Gotta make sure your knives is working.
Indeed, Wayne said. Why, sometimes the sharp ends on mine need lots of testing, to make sure they don't break down in the middle of a good killing. They shared a laugh, and Marcy shook her head. Wayne was in his element. He could talk about stabbing rich people all day long. Never mind that he himself was wealthier now than most of Ellendale. She didn't much care to listen to them as they continued to laugh and joke, but unfortunately she also didn't want to get too far away in this darkness. Yes, the mists were supposed to belong to the survivor, but rusts. Every second tombstone looked like a figure stumbling toward her in the night. Eventually, the gravekeeper led them to a freshly filled grave tucked away behind a few larger mausoleums. It was unmarked, save for the sign of the spear, carved in stone and set into the dirt. Nearby, a few other new graves, these open, awaited corpses.
"You might want to grab a seat," the champ said, hefting his shovel. "This'll go fast since the grave is upturned, but not that fast. And you might tell the lady to watch the other way. There's no telling what bits I might toss up."
"Grab a seat," Wayne said, looking around at the field of tombstones.
"Where, my good man?"
"Anywhere," the champ said, starting to dig.
"They don't care none. That's the motto of the gravekeeper, you know. Just remember, they don't care none."
And he set to it.